Hle kazi.
Hawu siyaphila.
Philile nathi apha KwaZulu-Natal.
Hawu ndisendiyibonileke sowuthumela umyalezo.
Ba.
Andiwubonile.
Sinenkinga ye-network apha ibuye inqamuke baba ngazi kwenze njani.
Okay.
Besingena ugesi for some days la emakhaya ezilaleni. Ukuqhume ama in substation or uzokongwelezana usho ukuthi line oza lapha emakhaya. And sibe nenkinga i-network buyinqamuke ihamba hamba ibuye buye buye buyinqamuka angazi kwenzakalani na. Nanxa sebe
Hey, sinazo ezonkinga ze-network. We will bear with you, Nkosi Cebekhulu.
Wow.
Yeah.
Thank you for that.
Thank you, thank you.
Morning, Chair.
Morning, morning. Come with Kibi.
How are you today, Comrade Chair? We from any message, I'm Chair.
And if you have responded already to your message.
Oh, dear. Thank you, Bon. And they're
good.
I'm on here for your Google. Okay, go sit there. Yo.
Go and consult the doctor immediately. Kunzimang. And goes, bye-bye.
Hi. Morning, Chairperson. It's Mantuli.
Honorable Julie, how are you?
No, I'm not well, but I alerted Masfole to say if I feel bad, I leave the message. I'm in the message.
About that. We are in the vulnerable age group now. Super Tidas Batal.
No, we had 2 days the hood and it was cold. I kept on drinking solar land or young because the palazeka cool.
Okay.
Solar land or young.
Okay. Morning, Chair.
Honorable I'm fine.
I know you are perfect. You are perfect, Honorable Chair.
Good morning. Every member speaking.
But are you doing okay?
No, I'm fine. No flu this time. I'm all right. And then the lage e concoction ya. Yeah, me be strong.
Yeah.
And it is not the concoction that.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
We need to sell it. Hospitalized for a week due to better cocoa. Then, please.
I will check. Honorable Cebekhulu. today's agenda item. And the public service on activities undertaken to curb corruption in the public service. A war against corruption begins to fix in from doing business. Laws have been put implementation and mess with the state without any further waste of violence. Commission will also promise before the acting DG presents. The apologies for their end.
Thank you, sir. The only apology was not able to attend.
Deputy Minister to take the platform and
thank you very much, Chairperson. Members of the portfolio on governments and however, I'm here representing, as you have indicated, Chairperson, it is and a developmental state. And in building that capable state, we want to have professional in accordance with the Constitution of the Republic, the Batupili principles, and the people who know what they are doing with diligence and in for efficient public service. In having public servants who are responsible and are accountable for their actions, omissions and commissions. Many public servants are hardworking, they are honest, they are competent, they are committed and accountable. But unfortunately, some have been seduced by greed and succumbed to corruption and have become unresponsive and unaccountable. To address these challenges of corruption and lack of accountability, government has implemented a number of interventions to monitor and enforce compliance among public servants. For instance, the Public Service Regulations of 2016 are one of the legislative frameworks that provide for a prohibition on public service employees conducting business with an organ of state. Regulation 13C states, and I quote it, an employee shall not conduct business with any organ of state or be a director of a public or private company conducting business with an organ of state unless such employee is an official is company listed in Schedule 2 and 3 of the Department of Public Service and Administration developed a number of directives to support the implementation of Regulation 13. Today, we will be receiving a comprehensive report on the employees that have been found to be conducting business with the state and the progress made to eliminate such behavior. I am, however, pleased to report to this meeting that part of the outcomes of the report that will be presented here include some decrease on the number of cases of public servants doing business with the state since the criminalization of such behavior. The decrease in the number of cases could be attributed, Chairperson, to the collaboration between the Department of Public Service and Administration, SAPS, Department of Justice, and NPA, and the level of awareness raised among public servants due to media reports on this collaboration, especially after the portfolio committee meeting held towards the end of 2020. This communicates to us that we are doing something right to ensure we manage state resources and are guarding against abuse and misuse of state resources. Honorable members, we'll also know that our public servants are faced with challenges of owning homes, just like the majority of South Africans. We have said this over and over again. Then the establishment of government employees housing scheme aimed to ensure that our public servants own quality homes that are affordable. The department has since inception of this resolution, which is Resolution 7 of 2015 of PSCPC, created a ring-fenced funded project management office additional to the DPSA establishment to implement the resolution. However, the uneven progress since the resolution prompted the relook at the scheme and approach in 2020, and the Ministry of Public Service and Administration approved a new strategy for the implementation of the scheme. In addressing this, the department has institutionalized functions of the scheme within the approved structure of the department. The reviewed strategy approach takes into consideration the successes, including lessons learned, challenges the scheme encountered, and challenges that have been registered by beneficiaries in terms of accessing the benefits of the scheme. So, honorable members, we are looking into everything about the scheme at this moment, and a lot of work is happening within the department. Our presentation in this meeting will therefore provide a detailed progress report on the established partnerships and collaboration we have currently to improve the services of the scheme, as well as to ensure it renders a professional and satisfactory service to public servants as intended. The presentation will provide clarity on the existing benefits and the requirements that members should comply with to access those benefits. Honorable members, at this moment, I will hand over by leading the PSC to make the presentation as per the request of the chairperson. Of public service and
the chairperson in address as well.
I am Mike Silwan. I am the convener of the Integrity . So the chairperson has delegated me to come and make presentation together with the DDG, who is responsible for integrity and anti-corruption. That is DDG Matume Malazi, who is in the meeting. Let me just start by indicating that our role as a commission is to, amongst others, promote a high standard of public a high standard of professional ethics in the public service. And amongst those is to manage in the financial disclosure framework. So public service regulations give us the responsibility to receive interest. And if the PSC is of the opinion that there will exist a conflict of interest in the disclosures that have been sent, we then advise the minister through a letter where there will be recommendations or advice on what actions that should be taken to minimize or remove the conflict of interest at all. And the conflict of interest, it may be an actual one or a potential one. And that's what we do as far as the financial disclosure framework is concerned. So on an annual basis, we develop an overview of all the departments, how they submit and their performance on submission, and scrutinize the forms from all those senior managers who are about 10,000 of them. It is important at this point to indicate that only about 15 officials are responsible for scrutinizing all these disclosure forms from senior managers, which are about 10,000. So the capacity sometimes is an issue. So the portfolio committee requested us to make a presentation on officials who conduct business with organs of state. Now, the presentation that we make, which comes from the overview on financial disclosure framework of senior managers, it will indicate issues of conflict of interest, including some of the officials who are conducting business with the state. And through this report or this piece of work that we're doing, we see ourselves as playing a meaningful role or a bigger role in terms of discussions or proposals.
Okay. So put on their videos.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you very much. I wonder. Oh, it shows another.
Do on the rocks. We want your picture.
Yeah, I'm. My apologies.
Okay. Continue, but whoever is going to speak thereafter must put on the video. Continue now, because this is a big problem of the...
Chair, my apologies. There's an issue with the settings. I will do that at some stage. Maybe let me just continue and then allow the DDG to take the portfolio committee through, and then I will work on my settings. So, yeah. Chair, what I was indicating is that through the work on financial disclosure framework, we are then able to touch on those officials at senior management level who are engaged in conducting business with the state. So the scrutiny will reveal those officials. And then I will allow the DDG to take the portfolio committee through the details of the presentation, and then in that process I will look at the settings. DDG Malazi, you can come in.
Thank you, Commissioner. Good morning, Honorable Chairperson and members of your committee. Good morning, DM and the DG of the Public Service Administration. Let me continue with the presentation. I would request that whoever has rights, please give them to Commissioner Slwani, so that he can share the presentation we are going to talk about. We have circulated and we have tabled presentation, and I hope that members do have these documents that I'm talking about. Allow me, Chairperson, not to repeat what the Commissioner Slwan had already talked to. My name is Madume Malachi. I'm the Deputy Director General, Integrity and Anti-Corruption in the Public Service Commission. The mandate of the PSC overall is to promote in section 195 of the Constitution, to investigate, monitor, administration and personnel practices of the public service, propose measures to ensure effective and efficient performance within the public service. We do give directions aimed at ensuring personnel procedures relating to recruitment. We also investigate personnel. Then there EA, the relevant authority. As to this August committee, the issue of the financial disclosure framework with a particular emphasis of those officials who were found to be doing business with the state. Let's move up one slide. Because all of what is on the screen now has been shared by Commissioner Slwani. The Commissioner, move up the slide. This is the slide that we want to share with you, honorable members. We are reflecting the compliance with Regulation 18 and 19 of the Public Service Regulation relating to disclosures, which requires that by the 31st of May, SMS members shall have disclosed their financial interest in their department, and their departments will release all of that to the Public Service Commission. So we indicate 20% of the 32. We indicate that this is a 1 percentage point increase in terms compared to the previous year, 2018-2019. Despite this increase, the submission rate recorded in respect of the current reporting period is still 1 percentage point in the compliance rate of the move. Now there is a table. The forms that we received, what did they consist of? We say 9753 SMS members who were in the system disclosed their registrable interest during that period as required by Regulation 18.1. So they complied. Members should note that compliance does not necessarily mean or translate into this. Because after this, there's going to be a scrutiny that we conduct where we evaluate whether people have disclosed accurately issues that they need to disclose, and there are no contradictions. We do that by comparing the disclosed information and data from third-party institutions that are working with us in this regard, like the DIS registry, CIPS, INATIS. 15 SMS 2020 and disclosed their financial interests during the month of May 2020. 95 SMS members who were already in the system prior to 1 April 2020, but only disclosed their financial interest during the month of May. So here we are detailing of those who have disclosed, how did it happen? There is a 2% of forms that were still outstanding as at the due date of 31st May 2020. And we attribute this to the State Security Agency, whose forms were not submitted at all. We can report to this committee that we engaged with the State Security Agency and they undertook to submit these forms to the PSC. However, that did not happen. And members would know that this emanates from that issue of saying they operate with confidential staff, and they thought they could not, they are not required to disclose. But in terms of the law and the research that we did, members of the State Security Agency are required to disclose their interest. And we had plans in place to enable them to disclose, you know, working together with the Inspector General. Apart from the SSA, there are also other SMS members, including 5 Director Generals and 4 Heads of Departments, whose forms were not submitted to the PSC as at the due date of 31st May 2020. We emphasize this point because it's a compliance point. It's required by the regulations. And these are the accounting officers. They must lead by example. Although you will see in the next slide that they have submitted to their executive authorities, but there was a delay there in releasing the information to the Public Service Commission, either because the minister was new or the ethics officer was new and did not advise the EA on time, reminding them to release the forms to the PSC. In other instances, the EAs would say, they are conducting verification themselves before releasing the forms because they don't want just to release and only to find that there are issues which they were not aware of. But we always, upon receipt and after scrutiny, we advise them accordingly what are the findings and which steps they need to take. So we are saying here they need not waste time trying to verify, because that is the assignment that is given to us to assist them with. The second slide continues to show, this is just those departments or the director generals whose forms were received later after the due date. The next slide will show also the four HODs. Let's move up, Commissioner. Yes, here we show the, you would have seen that the HODs are also indicated which departments they belong to. So we will pass this, but just for you to note, we still have that issue of state security that is unresolved, but we keep following it up with the colleagues that side. Now, here is the findings emanating from the scrutiny. The scrutiny is that as an exercise of checking what is on the disclosed on the form and what is available in the third party databases. We say 21% of the SMS members who have interest in companies did not disclose their companies. And this is a contravention to the regulation 19 of the public service regulation. 69% of the SMS members who did not disclose their financial interest in companies are repeat offenders. What the SS commissioner has alluded to, whenever we come at this point, and these are our findings, we communicate them to the EA and request them to take the appropriate steps. The appropriate steps will include calling the officials involved, asking them, giving them their side of the story to explain why is this the case, even after so many awareness has been raised about the importance of disclosure, that we want to manage conflict of interest in the workplace, particularly at this level of management. I'm going now to show that one of the disclosed companies, undisclosed companies, is in Gauteng province that was found to have conducted business with two organs of state, and we named them there.
I didn't catch that. The national, could you try again?
The National Department of Education. And also in the KZN. So the next slide talks to non-disclosure of immovable properties. We say a total of 361, which consists of 4% of SMS members in the public service, did not disclose their ownership of immovable properties during 2019-2020 financial year. Among these SMS members who did not disclose their properties, we break them down there, that two DGs in national departments and two HODs with one each in Limpopo and Mpumalanga provinces. There's in total 19 SMS members who have repeatedly failed to disclose their ownership of immovable properties during the period under review. Now we move on to non-disclosure of motor vehicles, where we found that 8% of SMS members in the public service did not disclose their ownership of motor vehicles during 2019 and 20 financial years. Among the defaulting SMS in this regard, we break it down there. We have four DGs in the national department and 10 HODs in the provincial department. This is all data that is available in our possession, which can be shared with as and when is required. Because sometimes during corruption investigations, we are approached as the PSC to provide these details as to non-disclosures, those assets that are not were not disclosed, which often get found that they can be regarded as gratification. So we have been assisting law enforcement agency with 205, what we call 205. In other words, we give an affidavit and attest to what was disclosed and whether it was legal or illegal. A total of 6% of the SMS members who did not disclose the ownership of vehicles are repeat offenders. We are going to move on to the next slide. A potential conflict of interest. Commissioner has explained what this is. During the period under review, which is 2019-2020, we have 1,508 SMS members who were involved in activities that could be construed as potential conflict of interest. For instance, you'll have a SMS members company registered on the central database. So in that case, at any given time, that person can be able to do business. So we say it's a potential conflict of interest. And we advise the EAs to call these people, talk to them, and make sure that they know they cannot do business with the state. If they were to do business outside of the public service, they need to be authorized for remuneration outside the public service. We say this accounted for 15% of all SMS members whose forms were scrutinized by the PSC. Here I just need to indicate we have a compliance rate, meaning the people who submit the forms by a particular date. Then we have a scrutiny that we conduct. When we conduct a scrutiny, because we have data of who is appointed by government as the SMS members, we scrutinize all financial interest of all SMS members. So just to make that point clear, that we do scrutinize even the forms of those that have not submitted their e-disclosures. We move, actual conflict of interest is the example of the case that I already pointed out where a person was contracting to National Basic Education and to a department in KZN. And this is a matter of great concern because the conducting of business is now criminalized. And that's the message all leaders have been conveying. We have been conveying as well. The minister has referred about 1,000, Minister Senzo Mkunu, referred about 1,500 officials to SAPS for investigation and criminal prosecution in the past year. So it is a very serious issue which we need PAs to internalize and make sure that in their departments it doesn't happen. We move on to the next slide, Commissioner. We indicate here that 11 cases of actual conflict of interest were recorded in the public service during the 2019-2020 financial year, and we give a breakdown of what where those conflict of interest were identified. In the national departments, there was one case and 10 were recorded. Three provincial departments, we indicate the, which ones are they, Free State, Gauteng, two of whom are the HOD of Human Settlement and the former HOD of Health in that province. Here we talk about Gauteng province and the Northern Cape with one case involving an HOD, HOD of Transport Safety and Liaison. Conducting business with an organ of state, this is what I just explained. It is outlawed, it's criminalized in terms of Regulation 13C of the Public Service Regulation and Section 8.2 of the PAMA Act 11 of 2014. So this is where criminal prosecution will take place with regard to identified officials. We move on to the next slide. Engagement in other remunerative work. The scrutiny revealed that 4% of the SMS members in the public service were engaged in other remunerative work during the period under review. 199 of these SMS members, which this constitutes a 52%, provided proof that they obtained prior permission to do so in terms of Section 30 of the Act. And the issue here, even if there is proof obtained, we must guard against abuse of state resources, assets for private interest, like fax, telephone, email. You find the person is conducting that business which has been authorized but now using state assets. The EAs were advised to take appropriate steps in terms of Section 31 of the Act. This is where the Act says they must follow the matter up, discipline the those that are not authorized, and even recover and pay into revenue an amount equal to that of any such remuneration. We are going to move up the slide. Now we talk about receipt of gifts and sponsorship from sources other than family members. So here the scrutiny of the 2019-2020 revealed that the combined value of gifts that were received in 2019-2020 financial year came to about 4,600,000. And it was less from the one that of the preceding year, which was 8 million. The issue with gifts, this is where corruption is hidden. You undertake a trip to Mauritius paid by a service provider and not disclose it. That is gratification. If it's a service provider in your department or elsewhere, then you need to disclose it and the circumstances under which it happened. It's some of the investigations by law enforcement relates to such trips undertaken and sponsored, which in the final analysis at that point, it comes out that there was a gratification because this is the service provider that is rendering business in that HOD or senior manager's department. So we collaborate with law enforcement as and when such information is required, and we depose the necessary affidavits to make sure that these people do not get away with it. There are SMS members who disclosed departmental gifts and so on when they attend conferences and seminars. Receipt of gifts, sponsorship, we have passed this. We can pass this slide, Commissioner. The next slide. Compliance with the requirement to take actions and report back to the public service on the details of the actions taken. So every time we advise the EAs and we indicate under these circumstances, the EA is required to institute disciplinary action or to consult with officials. We do expect feedback, which is, it is provided, but not all the EAs do provide feedback. We indicate here that EAs were satisfied with the responses given by some 260 of their SMS members during the consultation process, because that's what the regulations say. A total of 164 SMS members who did not disclose registrable interest and those with potential conflict of interest were sensitized of the need to comply with the regulations and to avoid conflict of interest. And this will be included in the feedback as it comes back to the PSC. Disciplinary actions were taken against 82 SMS members who contravened the provisions of the financial disclosures framework. Again here, the outcomes, most sanctions is written warnings, final written warnings, according to the information in our records. Recommendations. We say relevant EAs must act decisively against these HODs, DGs who do not comply with the framework in order to engage, to engender the culture of compliance from the top. But as alluded, I indicate that the DGs and those HODs pointed to had their forms submitted to the EAs, but EAs delayed in releasing them to the PSC. Repeat offenders must be dealt with more harshly when actions are taken against them. Ethics officers must periodically consult the central database, central supplier database of the National Treasury to check if companies linked to SMS members in their department and first are not doing business, but secondly that there are no such companies, because once you go and put it there, your intention can only be one, to conduct business. And at the time the business is awarded, nobody is alert to that activity. So we discourage that SMS members have their companies registered on central supplier database. In case of actual conflict of interest, EAs must initiate investigations for purposes of disciplinary inquiry in terms of the directive on conducting business with organs of state, which was issued by the Minister for Public Service and Administration in January 2017. Where appropriate, criminal case must be opened with the South African Police Service against the affected SMS members in terms of Section 8(3) of PAMA. Let's move on, Commissioner. We are almost concluding, Chairperson. Next slide. In case of cases of non-compliance with Section 30 of the Public Service Act, the EAs must invoke the provisions of Section 31. I already explained this one. This is where this other remunerative work that is conducted outside the public service. The PSC is of the view that the Minister for the Public Service and Administration must continue to issue guidelines detailing which of the sponsorships may not be disclosed for purposes of the financial disclosure framework. This is things like conference packages and so on, because that's what most SMS members would disclose. EAs must, within 30 days of receipt of the PSC report, at least acknowledge receipt of the PSC report and provide an indication on how the recommendations will be dealt with. This one, we take it up with ethics officers, with chief of staff, just to say, don't sit with documents and not even say, we have received the report from PSC, we're actioning it, then we'll revert to you once we are done with actioning it. And I think this was the next one, is the last slide. There is slight improvement overall in compliance with the requirements to submit financial disclosure forms. However, it is disconcerting that full disclosure of the registrable interest is still an issue. We don't have full disclosure, like we pointed, cars, immovable properties that were not disclosed. The challenge is the ability to manage, this poses a challenge to manage conflict of interest in the public service if there are registrable interests that have not been disclosed. And this is also compounded by the involvement of some of the HODs in the perpetuation of non-compliance with the regulatory framework. The EAs need to strengthen their resolve in enforcing full compliance with the regulatory provision under all circumstances and to dealing decisively with defaulting HODs. This would help in setting the tone from the top. In conclusion, that was the conclusion, Chairperson. We want to thank you for this opportunity. Honorable Chairperson, that's our presentation.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Yeah, Chairperson, let me just indicate that unfortunately I logged in through the link of Parliament and I didn't directly zoom in. So that's why I was unable to set the video on. So my apologies.
Okay. Thank you. Honorable members, because we have a sitting this afternoon, I think we must get the next presentation and then we discuss these presentations together. In the interest of time, this is a proposal I'm making.
I think it's the correct proposal, according to me, Honorable Chairperson. I agree with you. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mtsipe. Is there any dissenting view?
No,
None. Thank you very much. Can we get the next presentation by the department?
Thank you, Chairperson. With your permission, this is the Director General, Yoli Samakasi of the Department. I'm going to request that the head for the Technical Advisory Unit, Mr. Solomon, Dr. Solomon, please take over and present on the employees conducting business with the state and some of the interventions that we have put in place as the department. Over to you, Chairperson. I do need to highlight, Chairperson, though, that I think that we are experiencing similar challenges with director generals in terms of, or heads of departments in terms of really holding employees accountable, those who are found to be conducting business with the state and moving with the disciplinary processes within the departments. And Minister has indicated as part of the interventions, I think that in March, early in March, he will be addressing FOSAT, where there will be DGs from national as well as provincial departments, HODs, as part of dealing with these particular matters. But it's still remaining a challenge for us, that particular issue. Over to you, Solomon. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Solomon. Come in.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Morning, Honourable Chair, Ministers, Deputy Ministers, Committee Members, DGs and colleagues. I've been asked to prepare a briefing on public servants conducting business with the state and the number of officials imprisoned as per the public service regulation. Now, my presentation will cover introduction, interventions, the status as at 31st of January this year, investigations and the way forward. Now, since January 2017, the DPSA has been monitoring the implementation of Regulation 13 and also Regulation 8 or Section 8 of the Public Administration Management Act, which not only prohibits public service employees from conducting business with the state, but also criminalizes public service employees, advisors and public administration employees from conducting business with the state. Now, since then, numerous letters were directed to departments. The portfolio committee was briefed on the yearly increase of employees identified to be possibly conducting business with the state, and the departments who did not investigate cases, we've handed a list to the Portfolio Committee. Now, since 2017, we observed a steady increase in the names of public service employees listed on the Central Supplier Database. Central Supplier Database plays the role where you need to register on this database before you can do business with the state. So when your name is flagged on this, it means that you have the intention to do business with the state. So in 2017, we found that there were 580 public service employees on the list. It increased 2018 to 679. In 2019, it increased to 1,068. And 2020, it increased to 1,539. But as the Deputy Minister indicated this morning, in 2021, January, we found that there's only 484 public service employees listed on the CSD, and they are possibly conducting business with the state, possibly because they may have been appointed in an official capacity, some of them, and some may also have resigned and that the names still reflect on PERSAL and therefore they flagged, or that the departments appointed them under a wrong code, that they're actually not public service employees. So that is why we, to address the list of 1,539 employees, we have drafted a template and we sent it on the 30th of June 2020 to the 28 national departments and all the offices of premiers who had employees listed on that list, so that we can sanitize the list to see who are the people that were wrongfully flagged, or those who already resigned, or those who were acting in an official capacity. And we requested feedback by the 15th of July 2020. Now, we received feedback from the following departments on the screen: basic education, employment and labor, environmental affairs, forestry and fisheries, government, communication and digital technologies, health, Office of the Chief Justice, Office of the Public Service Commission, Science and Technology, the South African Police Service at a later stage, who they first requested extension, and then the Statistics South Africa, Tourism, Trade Industry and Competition. Now, the following national departments did not respond: Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development, Cooperative Governance, Correctional Services, Higher Education and Training, Home Affairs, Human Settlement, International Relations and Cooperation. We also received responses from the following provincial departments: in KwaZulu-Natal. We got feedback from the Agriculture and Rural Development, Arts and Culture, Community Safety and Liaison, Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, Education, Human Settlements, Office of the Premier, Public Works, Social Development, Sport and Recreation, Transport. The Western Cape, we received feedback from Agriculture, Department of the Premier, Education, Health and Provincial Treasury. Northern Cape, we got feedback from Cooperative Governance, Human Settlements and Traditional Affairs, Health, Office of the Premier, Social Development, Sport, Arts and Culture, Transport, Safety and Liaison. Now, based on the fact that we received slow trickle of information from the department, Minister Mkulu, the Minister for the Public Service and Administration, on the 22nd of July 2020, invited the Minister of Police and the Minister of Correctional Services to have a meeting where they decided that there's a need to establish a multi-departmental team coordinated by the DGs of the respective ministries to ensure that the allegations regarding employees possibly conducting business with the state are investigated and that those who are found guilty are prosecuted. So the 24th of August, the DGs of the multi-departmental team met and approved an MOU, which clearly highlighted the roles and responsibilities of each department. And this was accompanied by a multidisciplinary plan of action, focusing on 10 priority cases and on dealing with a list of the employees identified in 2020 to be possibly conducting business with the state. So in terms of the MOU, the DPSA will identify the employees registered on the Central Supply Database as per our mandate, and we will be assisted by the National Treasury in doing so. But because the DPSA cannot discipline employees from other departments, it is up to the departments to investigate and then to discipline their employees, and then to report criminality to the SAPS, where the SAPS will then investigate the cases. And where they find that there's enough evidence, they will hand it to the NPA to prosecute. Now, the SAPS was then provided with a list of all the 1,539 public service employees who were possibly conducting business with the state. And on the 4th of September, they started with a process to clear the individuals on the list, and they identified 579 individuals on this list that may be conducting business with the state. On the screen, you will see the breakdown of that number, 579, of which 157 of national departments, and then the rest in the respective provinces. Now, to assist the departments who received letters of employees possibly conducting business with the state, the DPSA arranged two training sessions, virtual training sessions, one in August and one in September last year, where all those ethics officers who had employees in their departments possibly conducting business with the state and investigators of those departments were invited, and they were trained by the SAT on how to investigate employees conducting business with the state. So on the 15th of December 2020, the DPSA then forwarded follow-up letters to the departments listed by SAPS and requested feedback by the 23rd of December 2020. We received confirmation from those who already confirmed in June, and then the other departments also responded, like the National Department of Public Works and Infrastructure, and then the following provincial departments from Limpopo: Health, Economic Development, Environment and Tourism, Agriculture and Rural Development, and Education. So, Chairperson, if we look at the status on the CSD and we compare that to last year, January or March 2020, we found that there's a decline from 2020 to 484 in 2021, which is still less than the 579 identified by SAPS in September last year. So it looks like there is a decline in the number of public servants who registers themselves on the CSD to be able to conduct business with the state. Now, the national departments, 2020, we had 29 national departments with employees possibly conducting business with the state. That dropped to 17. The provincial departments, we had 13 in 2020 in KwaZulu-Natal. That is now 7. And it means that there's 8 KwaZulu-Natal departments who have no employees conducting business with the state, which is an increase of 1. From 2020. Gauteng, we found it decreased from 11 to 7 of employees conducting business with the state, and meaning that there's now 7 departments who have no employees conducting business with the state, which were in 2020 only 3. Now, Northwest, we've also found a decline to 2. Eastern Cape, a decline to 10. Limpopo, a decline to 4. Mpumalanga, a decline to 7. Free State, Northern Cape, and the Western Cape, all a decline. So it clearly indicates that the provinces we had in the past, a serious problem with employees conducting business with the state, are also experiencing a decrease in public servants and registering on the CSD. Now, Honourable Chair, if we come to the issue of investigations, one must remember we started the investigations in September last year, so it's a 6-month period. So most of the cases are still being investigated, not only by departments, but also those who the departments forwarded to SAPS. If we look at the SAPS investigations, they are harder to work to investigate the SAPS employees who had been identified in the process. And on 28th of October, they indicated in a report to the DPSA that they identified 78 employees to be conducting business with the state, with 49 of them being active directors of companies registered on the CSD, 19 being inactive or resigned directors, and 10 whose identity numbers they could not see recognized on the SIPC. So they indicated that the disciplinary processes were at different stages, that they have 7 criminal cases and 1 criminal inquiry registered against SAPS members. And this included of the 10 priority cases that were given to SAPS by the interdisciplinary team. 7 of the cases, of the 10 priority cases, they have been already started with work. Now, on the 21st of January, SAPS indicated that they are still investigating 1 case, which the DPSA forwarded to the SAPS for investigation upon receiving it from the Department of Science and Innovation of a possible case where an individual conducted business with the state. SAPS also indicated that they have 9 cases still involving SAPS members, of which 1 case involves 4 SAPS officials. Now, Honourable Chair, if we look at all the investigations from a departmental perspective, which the departments actually are the first point of entry, if they do not investigate the cases, SAPS cannot investigate, because they must investigate and then find the evidence for conducting business with the state and hand it to the SAPS for further investigation. So out of the 484 cases identified, national departments investigated 83 cases already that they started with, and 42 cases were not investigated. Provinces started with the investigation of 94 cases, investigated 94 cases, and 264 are still outstanding. If we look at the no responses that we received, 46 departments indicated the no response or gave us no response. 5 national departments, you'll see agriculture, land reform, rural development, higher education, training, justice and constitutional development, correctional services and water and sanitation, and 41 provincial departments did not give us a response. That is now the one in health, KwaZulu-Natal, Gauteng, we had the community safety, economic development, education, health, human settlements, provincial treasury, roads and transport. It did not give us any response. In terms of Northwest, the education and sports development and health did not give a response. The Eastern Cape, it was a cooperative governance and traditional affairs, education, health, office of the premier, provincial treasury, roads and public works, rural development and agrarian reform, social development, sport, recreation, arts and culture, and transport. Limpopo, the following two, social development and then cooperative governance, human settlements and traditional affairs. Mpumalanga, it's agriculture, rural development, land and environmental affairs, community safety, security and liaison, cooperative governance and traditional affairs, culture, sport and recreation, education, health, public works, roads and transport. The Free State, it's education, health, police, roads and transport, provincial treasury, social development. And then Northern Cape, it was agriculture, land reform and rural development, education, economic development and tourism, provincial treasury, roads and public works. And then for the Western Cape, it was cultural affairs and sport, economic development and tourism. Now, the departments who commenced with investigations, who indicated to us that they commenced with investigations, it's 17, of which 6 is national departments. The Department of Basic Education, Environmental Affairs, Forestry and Fisheries, SAPS, Tourism, Public Works and Infrastructure, and Trade, Industry and Infrastructure. The 11 provincial departments is KwaZulu-Natal, Agriculture and Rural Development, KwaZulu-Natal Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs, KwaZulu-Natal Education, KwaZulu-Natal Office of the Premier, KwaZulu-Natal Transport, and then Limpopo Education, Northern Cape Cooperative Governance, Human Settlements and Traditional Affairs, Northern Cape Health, Northern Cape Social Development, Western Cape Education, and Western Cape Health. So the cases that were indicated to us to be finalized and where employees were found guilty, it's one, National Department Employment and Labour. Now, the cases finalized and not found guilty were four national departments, CPME, Science and Technology, Social Development and SATS. And cases referred for disciplinary hearing, two national departments, SATS and Social Development, and one provincial department, the Northern Cape Health. Criminal charges, that's one national department that had criminal charges, SAPS, and then also one provincial department, Limpopo Health, which indicated they referred cases to SAPS for investigation and for criminal charges. So, Honourable Chair, this brings me to the conclusion where I can assure you that the DPSA is continuously following up with departments who's not investigating the cases. We also provide technical assistance for those who require such. We are also supported by the police, by two specific brigadiers who provide technical assistance to the departments who require that assistance to investigate their cases. The DPSA is also in constant liaison with SAPS regarding the referred cases. And I would humbly make a plea that SAPS be invited to present on the progress regarding the referred cases, because it's not in the purview of the DPSA to present on those cases. And then, as indicated by the DG in the beginning of the session, the Minister for Public Service and Administration indicated that he's going to have a special for that in March, where this matter will be addressed with all the departments who's not responding and are investigating their cases, to be present at the meeting. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Honorable members, both presentations are now open for discussion. Can I get members who want to speak to show their hands on the platform? I see Honorable Soma, your hand is already up. Honorable Qebekhulu. Honorable Schreiber, in that order.
Thank you, Chair. My apology, I won't show face because I've got a difficulty with connectivity here at the village, but I'll just show it for 1 second to follow your instruction. There's me, clicking there, that's me, Honorable Chair. Thank you very much. Let me just switch it off my video with your permission. Chair, probably one must start with appreciating and a slight excitement from the day last year, if all of us, you recall, Chairperson, that we did engage on this matter where we requested a detailed a report in terms of who and how much and at what stage are those issues in terms of investigating. And then we were hoping, but in a way, Chair, both DPSA and PSC have covered that in terms of, which, lacking for a better word, I'll say name and shame. But also I'll request that if they can go back to the slides that they gave us last year and also give us a status specifically per province, per department, per individual in terms of senior management, and how far specifically are those cases? Because our template that we would like to see the progress would be based on that, and whether also are there any additional offenders, as it were, which undermine the laws of public services, as it were. But I'm saying one is encourage that the department, in particular, Honorable Minister, is following this thing up to the T. But the other one, Chair, that I would like to make a comment to take home by the DM, is whereby the officials, they allege that they've been instructed by whether political or whoever. That's one. Two, also what I would like also the investigation when it's done on a specific matter, it does a follow-up where officials do business with the state, but not in their department, such as in other provinces or other departments, whether there is no trade-offs of officials in that space as well, because it would be defeating the intention if there is still that trade-offs that are being done. If they are, I'm not saying they are, because I don't have evidence, I can't make that allegation, but I think the space that needs to be looked at. Chair, in terms of PSC, I've heard that they're saying that the EAs, in some instances, they might not upload the information to the portal that indicates whether they've cleared that, they've satisfied, they signed it off, the declaration of financial interest of an individual senior management, as it were. But also for me, I think the system that needs to be developed, both DPSA and DPM and Public Service Commission, is that which will be able the system automatically to ensure that, to reflect that a individual has submitted, but because of the changes of the new EA or whatever, but it's able then to, for that particular official to be seen having complied, than to wait for the EAs. But also, I don't know whether the DM will take it home to say, I fail to understand, as Commissioner Swan has said, that they are the ones who can cross-check why the department wants to do double job. Is it a lower level of confidence to the Public Service Commission? I don't think it's an intended one, but it seems slightly to suggest that. And I'm saying that they must just say, how do they smooth that process so that also there's a better appreciation from both parties, which then a Public Service Commission then can do the latter part as it were, so that the picture can improve. The other one, Chair, just have some notes here, forgive me. I've spoken to this. The name and shame, I've spoken to that. I'm not too sure, but I'll just slightly also go into DPSA. If the department may also, for the benefit, if they have said that, but I'll just ask the question, I might have omitted that in terms of the listening, that can they clarify on cases where public servants were found to be conducting business with the state, however, were found not to be guilty? Are there such instances? But what would be the cost for them to terminate them from that? Maybe the department provided clarity on that one. Such as, for an example, there was with DPME, if I'm not mistaken, and science and technology. With regards to the configuration of the system, which I've partially spoken to say that of the system, how far in terms of the configuration of the system, how far is that process thus far, particularly with the departments that are not in the system? Because last time, when you report to us, there were some departments that were not in the system. And I believe that is mandatory for all the departments to be in the system so that automatically we're able to use so-called the dashboard to monitor the progress thereof. The very last one, Chair. One would be happy that probably in the near future when they come back to us, they don't give us a round figure, but they break those figures specifically to provinces and the departments, and also how much has been recuperated in that process of making sure that we stop and make sure that we lead by example in terms of those culprits or serial offenders, as it were. With that, Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity. And I think the department is in the right pace. Even the ethics unit also will do a very good job in terms of cleaning the system. Hopefully, by end of this term, we'll have made the mark. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. Nkosi Qobekulu.
Chairperson, thank you for the opportunity. And thanks for the presentations from the Commission as well as the Department. Chairperson, one would like to point out, you know, this is a, if I could call, it's a big elephant in the room to stop employees of the state doing business with the state, because people have many ways of bypassing the system that has been put in place by the department. You know, Chairperson, what one has been exposed to is the fact that, you know, in some instances, you find that the officials or the employees of the state use relatives, companies, and they are doing fronting with their relatives' companies into getting access to doing business with the state, which I find might be very difficult for the department to sort of stop it. The tap is on when it comes to dealing with these issues, Chairperson. This is a comment that I'm trying to make with regards to the challenges department the state is facing with regards to employees doing business with the state, although they know it's not acceptable and not allowed by law. Chairperson, I was just listening to the presentations. One thing I have identified in the area in the report of the KZN, where they were sort of saying they don't include traditional leaders, which is Isinduna and Amakhosi, as part of the employees of the state. And what one sees in the rest of the provinces where there are departments of traditional affairs, not all of them have come up except for the KZN. Thirdly, the unwillingness of some of the departments in different provinces not to cooperate. This gives a challenge when you see that some provinces, provincial departments, don't simply give what is expected of them. I'll say that they simply pretend as though they don't give a damn on working cooperatively with the PSC as well as the department. And what is the department doing to sort of throw those departments to do as they are expected in order to sort of expose those employees who are not being we are not being cooperative and abide by what departments are expecting. That was just my take, Chairperson. I'll like to stop there.
Honorable Sraiba.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning. Good morning to the colleagues and good morning to the officials. Chair, I have a couple of concerns, but first of all, I do want to thank the officials for the work that has been going into this. I do appreciate that the DPSA is not in a position to actually get convictions or even force some of these departments to respond. Having said that, I think that the failure by, I think it was five departments to respond to the templates that are sent out, even when there's reminders sent out by letters, that is certainly a serious issue. And I think the appeal should go here to the Deputy Minister, that this is a place where some political unclogging might be necessary, where the Minister or the DM can please step in and make sure that the leaders of these departments who are not responding understand that it's not optional, that this is a legal requirement, that and the DPSA is trying to get this information from them. Chair, I think the other big concern for me is, however, the conviction rate, if we want to use that term. And I refer to either people found guilty in disciplinary processes or indeed the SAPS investigations that were referenced during the presentation. I think that, if I understood it correctly, there's only been one criminal conviction out of all these cases that have been, or potential cases that have been identified. I'd like to echo the question from the Honorable Lesoma about what are the reasons for such a low conversion rate, that's perhaps the better word, of suspected cases into disciplinary action and criminal convictions. And I think we must follow up on the suggestion to get SAPS, Chairperson, to present to us and give us some more detail on what the issue is there, because it sounds to me like a lot of the evidence or the information that would be required to follow up through investigations or criminal investigations are actually already available. They are collected, they are collated by the department. So we need to understand what exactly is the holdup that's causing this low conversion rate. I'd like to ask the officials if there is anything they can tell us about why there is that low conversion rate from suspected or identified cases into disciplinary action and criminal convictions, keeping in mind perhaps that the DPSA does have a stronger hand to play when it comes to the disciplinary cases, if not the criminal convictions. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Gondwe.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I have questions for the PSC, the Public Service Commission, and the DPSA. With regards to the presentation by the PSC, they indicate that 2% of the outstanding forms as at 31 May are attributable to the SSA. And because the financial disclosure forms from all the SSA members were not submitted at all. Now, I want to know, and then in the course of the presentation, there was an explanation given that they did engage them and they undertook to submit these forms, but this did not happen. And I tend to echo the sentiments of Honorable Schreiber that perhaps there needs to be some political involvement in the sense that the ministers need to, you know, to flag these issues with one another. To my knowledge, having sat on the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, these disclosures pertain to the individual, and I don't know if unless they are trying to say that they're holding assets in their official capacity, but I don't know how that would compromise the operations of the SSA. So this is very concerning that you have departments such as the SSA who, are not submitting at all because they're under the impression that given the nature of their work, et cetera. And I'm worried that this will only cover up whatever is going wrong, you know. You indicate as well in the presentation that 21% of SMS members with interest in companies did not disclose their companies. Please elaborate. Are you trying to say that They failed to disclose that they had interest in the companies, or they just failed to disclose the names of the companies that they have interest in. And then you also indicate that 11% of SMS members who did not disclose their interest in companies are repeat offenders. Was there any action initially taken against these repeat offenders when they initially, you know, committed this offense of not disclosing their interest in companies? Because, you know, people repeat an offense if they know that there are no repercussions and, you know, there are no consequences. And it worries me that, you know, you have these repeat offenders, and all we can do at this stage is identify them, and no action is being taken against them. And, you know, that speaks to the fact that perhaps, you know, they know that there will be no sanction meted out, you know, if they continue, you know, committing, you know, this offense. And then you said EAs are failing to provide feedback on actions taken, and you indicate in the presentation that 30 out of the 146 EAs provided feedback, and you're constantly inundated with requests for extensions. Do you then grant these requests for extensions? How do you determine whether or not to grant an extension? Because I don't think granting these extensions it will solve matters, and it will only perpetuate this culture of non-compliance that you know we are seeing. And then in the recommendations, you know, it's all and well to share recommendations with us, but are you sharing these recommendations, you know, with the EAs and the particular, you know, the relevant ministers to say that we've got a problem in your department? You know, we're not getting this information, these disclosure forms, and I don't know whether a solution would be actually to attach, you know, the submission or the successful investigations of instances that are flagged to the performance agreements of these EAs, because I don't know how we're going to ensure that, you know, there is strict compliance, because at this stage, you know, we are still having a considerable number of employees that are just not complying, you know, for whatever reason. And so I'm a bit worried. And then the framework, the financial disclosure framework, how often is it reviewed? Because I'm worried that because it's not being reviewed as often as it should be, you know, it's just a framework on paper and it doesn't have teeth. Of course, there's an improvement. I'm not taking away from the fact that there's an improvement, but I'm still worried that we still have instances where EAs are just not, considering this to be an important part of having a professional and ethical, you know, public service. So I'm a bit worried about that. And then the DPSA, let me applaud you for the interventions that you've put in place, especially that interdepartmental team that you've put together with yourselves and Justice, and the conclusion of the MOU by the relevant BGs. I'm a bit concerned that the ethics officers that were trained only received training from SAPS. Why were they not trained by the NPA? Because the NPA is the one that ultimately has to prosecute these cases once SAPS has finalized the investigation. And so it's very important, and I think that, you know, the ethics officers also receive training from the NPA. And then DPSA, there's a discrepancy between the figure that you came up with and the one that SAPS came up with, which is 579, and you came out 484. But you were both, you know, you both identified these individuals from the same database. So I'm a bit concerned that there is this discrepancy, although it's not very wide, but there is this. And how does it work? I wasn't entirely sure why there was this discrepancy. And I want to get an indication that out of the 484, I just need a holistic number. Out of the 484 cases that have been identified, how many are currently being investigated? And when I did my calculations, it was actually 265 that are outstanding. So I'm not entirely sure, and not 264. So if you could clarify that. I appreciate that the DPSA is in continuous communication with all the departments not investigating their cases and providing technical support where it's required. Are you giving them deadlines around, you know, submissions and not necessarily submissions, but around when the, you know, the investigations have to be finalized? Because, you know, we already have a problem of of disciplinary cases that are just outstanding in the public service. And I'm just worried that they're never ending and there's no conclusion to these disciplinary investigations. And as Honorable Schreiber pointed out, you know, we've yet to get, a successful prosecution. It's just people being criminally charged. But until such a time that people are actually prosecuted and convicted and thrown into prison, I don't think anybody's going to take this seriously. I agree that FAP has to be called in, and give the committee an update on the cases that have been referred to it for further investigation. As I indicated, until there's a successful prosecution and conviction, I don't think very much will change. And perhaps when SAPS comes in, we find out whether there's a dedicated team that deals with this issue. Perhaps that could also speed up the investigations around this issue. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honourable Maluleke.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me join Honourable Members who welcome to the presentation. I think it was a well.
Can you put on your video, Honourable Maluleke?
Chairperson, I will just, so that you can see me now, but I have a problem with my network. Can I just switch it off, please? Chairperson, firstly, I would like to commend the department for encouraging officials or the public servants in their department to submit their financial disclosure forms. But I'm not too happy with the 98% submission. I think this is a compulsory requirement of public servants to submit their disclosure forms, and 100% submission is expected. So I just hope that PSC will have to engage with departments to ensure that public servants, they comply with this requirement. Can PSC recommend to DPSA to come up with measures to ensure that all officials or public servants do comply on this requirement? And my second question would be, or maybe it's just a comment, can PSC tell the committee about the successful cases of using financial disclosure forms to prohibit public servants doing business with state and keeping corruption? If they can just share with us the good stories or successful cases that they have identified. And lastly, Chairperson, the PSC, when they are analyzing their financial disclosure forms from public servants, what does the PSC do when officials are disclosing as directors of companies in their financial disclosure forms? What is it that they are doing if the public servant is indicating that he's a director of a company in their financial disclosure forms? And secondly, does the system used to verify public servants' profiles able to determine whether officials' companies have conducted business with the state? Because we can say they must comply and we analyze those disclosure forms, but what is it that we want to get after analyzing those disclosure forms? Does the system have an indication of whether these companies are doing business with states, or what is it that is there when they analyze the disclosure forms? Chairperson, for now, thank you very much. I think some of the questions that I wanted to raise were raised by my honorable members who spoke before me. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Honorable Sibisi. Honorable Smith, it's your turn now.
Okay, thank you, Chairperson. Chair.
You can continue, Honorable Smith.
Okay, thank you. Thanks for the presentation. And we also wish to comment on what PSC has done for 2020. But although one is still concerned, when you look at the report, according to the report, it looks like SMEs, SOPs, EAs are failing to comply by not submitting their financial disclosure form. So is there any follow-up that is being done to check as to why they are not complying by submitting their disclosure form? Thanks, Chairperson, for now. Thank you.
Honorable Ntuli.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I'll also plead for my video to be switched off with your permission, please. Chair, my colleagues, firstly, we welcome the presentations. My colleagues have covered a lot of issues, particularly Honorable Lesoma. She covered me in some of the issues. Chair, on top of what Honorable Lesoma said, the naming and shaming, I wonder, Chair, if there is a way of sort of regulating on suspension without pay. To apply this regulations, particularly on the repeat offenders, I've got a serious concern, Chair, and the meeting to say we have even repeat offenders, meaning that you did it and you just got away with it without any harsh punishment. I think, Chair, it's high time that we apply harsh rules on such to protect the public service. And Chair, we noted the decline. We noted the decline, but it shows that this thing has been rooted. There are some people who are just defying. If you defy, the department must respond to you. But there's another thing, Chair. I wonder, there was a mention of a Schedule 2. I think it was a PSC, if I'm not mistaken. Just to elaborate on that one as to who, how, and when. And Chair, if we can see that that one also doesn't open the loophole, certain loopholes. Chair, I think, Chairperson, in terms of SARS, I don't know whether we can have the department can think of the discussions for the establishment of a special team, national, not to have the subs from KZN investigating people, the officials from KZN. And also to show the seriousness on the matter, to have a special team maybe on this financial year, and also change from time to time. Because for me, the involvement of SARS as well, because you saw that the Department of SARS is also mentioned to have been involved in such. The involvement of SARS is a worrying factor, because those are the people that are supposed to protect us and to protect the state. Chair, I think that's my take for now. Thank you.
Honorable Ntuli, Honorable Ntsepe.
Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson. I would like also to welcome the presentation, all the presentation that was presented here at the Portfolio Committee. First question from the Public Service Commission. In terms of the SMSs disclosed after the set date, and to those who did not disclose at all, because they know that they must comply by disclosing, no matter the minister was new. And then it was said that there was a disciplinary hearing, disciplinary that was being taken for, in terms of the disciplinary was taken, but it was a verbal warning. So according to EAs, must take decisively, they must act decisively. I don't think that when we talk about decisively, the warning letters can act as decisive. There must be a serious action must be taken to them. Because this thing of this issue emanates from the fifth parliament. And then when we come in on the sixth parliament, it was already there from the past one. So we are going to deal with this issue until Jesus comes, because this needs to be dealt with immediate effect. You must deal with it and done, so that the other ones must not repeat what the others did before. And then the other question in terms of the DPSA is with the employees of the SAPS identified to be in conducting business with the state, and with 49 of them being active directors of the companies registered on the CSD, and 10 employees who identified were not recognized. Question is this an indication of policy gap? Number two, will this be a need to identify this gap with a view to amending legislation or improving on regulations? And then the other question is,
What led the department to include, meaning the statistics of national departments, what led the department to conclude that only 17 departments down from 29 possibly have employees conducting business with an organ of state? And then the last thing, Honorable Chairperson, I would like to ask or to request the chair, can we request the overdue report which was made by DM Chikunga, which was so informative building the Department of Public Service and Administration. Really, that overview, according to me, it was good. And then it was maybe going to build us, and even the ones that is in the Department of Public Service and Administration. I'm requesting if can we have that overview report with due respect. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mutipe. I think the Honorable DM is hearing your request. She will do that as you have requested. Now let me allow the Public Service Commission and the department to respond to questions raised by honorable members.
The Public Service Commission. Honorable Chairperson. As I've indicated, my video is still much of a problem. I'll sort it out next time. It will be sorted out. Let me indicate that a number of questions that have been raised is mainly around regulatory framework, the laws and the regulations. As the Public Service Commission, our duty is to scrutinize and check if laws have been complied with, and if not, recommend that disciplinary action in terms of the public service regulations are enforced. So when it comes to officials who are repeat offenders, we were concerned as the commission that in the previous year we recommended, and then some of the EAs become satisfied with the explanation from the officials, and then the officials do it again the following year. So, and some of the EAs will come with written warning, and then even in the next year, warning, and then even in the next year, put another warning. So maybe that's where we need to tighten the regulations and ensure that you cannot get the same sanction for an offense on in two successive years. So that if you get a warning this year, the following year should be the final written warning, or people should be suspended without pay, as one honorable member indicated. So I think that's where we need to tighten up as far as compliance is concerned. The overview report that we tabled in Parliament, maybe the portfolio committee should engage with other portfolio committees. For example, if we take the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence, so the portfolio committee should discuss about the issue to submit the financial disclosure, and then be able to hold the Department of State Security Agency to account for those officials who have not complied. And the same could be done with health, with education, etc. So this report should not end only at the level of the Portfolio Committee on Public Administration, but that it should be shared with portfolio committees on health, education, etc. And so that those portfolio committees do engage the ministers and the DGs accordingly on these issues. When it comes to the EA is not, let's say the HOD or the DG submits by the 30th of April, and then the EA doesn't submit to the commission. There isn't a policy gap in that regard, because from 1 May up to 31 May, 31 days in which the EA has a responsibility to ensure that he or she checks the because it's only one form of the DG or of the HOD, that the DG or the HOD submitted correctly and check a conflict of interest, if any, so that when they send to the PSC, they send the full picture of what that official has submitted. Where there may be a policy gap, actually, I think it's a duplication, that the PSC should investigate if there is conflict of interest, but that does not absolve the DGs and the EA from investigating conflict of interest. So I think maybe PSC and Public Service and Administration Department should work out and see how to improve the e-disclosure system to make sure that there isn't a lot of duplication in the work that we are doing. More so that we do not have sufficient resources to be able to do the same work that departments are supposed to do. So the EOs, ethics officers, must be capacitated accordingly to be able to enter into the e-disclosure system, into CIPC system, and be able to scrutinize before a report is sent to the Public Service Commission, so that the commission is doing assurance to the portfolio committee or portfolio committees that indeed much work is being done in the different departments. And then when it comes to the issue of state security agency, we engaged with them fully in about two or three meetings. And then they were under the impression that for security reasons, they may compromise the security of the country when officials are disclosing their financial interests. We then indicated that the commission is not interested in those issues of state security per se, but it's interested in senior managers to disclose their personal financial interests, the houses they own, the companies they are directors in, the vehicles they own. So it is personal issues and not issues related to the day-to-day operations of employees. So they checked with the Inspector General, and the Inspector General agreed with them that they need to disclose, because it's disclosing personal interests of officials and not state security issues. But even after that, they still did not disclose. And that's where the Joint Standing Committee on Intelligence should be able to hold the Minister of Intelligence accountable to say they agreed to disclose, but still they didn't do that. So I think collaboration here is going to be more important. And then with respect to those that did not disclose completely, that is a misconduct in terms of the code of conduct for public servants. And then disciplinary action must take place. And then that's where I said maybe there's a need to tighten up sanctions so that if an offender is a repeat offender, that sanctions becomes more harsher, and that officials may be suspended or even dismissed if they are not interested in following the law. Because in Chapter 1 of the Constitution, That's where we say there is one of the values, founding values, is supremacy of the Constitution and the rule of law. So if the law prescribes in a particular way and officials are not following the law, what more about members of the public such? So it is important that especially senior managers must lead by example in terms of implementing public service regulations and the Public Service Act. When it comes to departments that implement the regulations, we see that over the past few years, there's been a decline in terms of the offenders, those who are not conducting business with the state. The number is increasing. Or those who are conducting business, the number is declining. So that is an encouraging sign. But again, SAPS needs to ensure that those officials that have violated PEM Act are charged, and then they are taken on trial, and then criminal charges, I mean criminal sanctions against criminal activities are taken. However, it is important to note that even SAPS itself, there are still officials, the police, who are still conducting business with the state. So somehow, one way or the other, there may be some conflict of interest in some of those policemen who are conducting business with the state, taking action against other officials who are conducting business with the state. So there is a need to collaborate and ensure that the conflict of interest is removed, and then that the officials are taken on board accordingly. So IP needs to be brought in as far as the officials in SAPS are concerned, and then SAPS take action on the rest of other officials. With respect to the review of regulations, the regulations were reviewed in 2017. And if you check the submission from 2017 upwards, so in 2017 it was 95%, and then in 2018-19 it was 99%. And then it has gone slightly in 1920 to 18%. So the review has taken place, and the improvements have been put into the public service regulations. And I think that's what portfolio committee and other portfolio committees should also help in that regard, to ensure that the review is done on regular basis and not to take 16 years before the review, like the first review from 2001 to 2017. So maybe every 5 years. I'm not sure that we need to discuss that with the DPSA, with the minister, to say how long should the review be on the code of conduct and the financial disclosure, which are all covered in the public service regulation. Maybe 5 years may be the most important to look at. The other questions, let me leave them to the DDG to answer on those questions, if ever I've missed other questions. DDG.
Thank you very much. Honorable Chairperson, there's just a very few questions that I will deal with. The first one is that issue of having a system to identify DGs and HODs who have submitted to their EAs, but for whatever reason, EAs do not release the documents to Public Service Commission. We welcome that, and we will put that in place. The Honorable Kebukulu identified something very critical in this area, where employees will bypass the system by using relatives, kids, parents, to be the ones who in whose names companies are registered. But the answer to that is going to be the lifestyle audit, which will follow the flow of monies and check what is happening, because it tells you money flows into this account. It's an elderly person, retired, then it goes back to son or daughter. Then it will tell you that this company has been registered just for the sake of circumventing the regulations that are there. So it is the work that is in the pipeline. The DPSA is helping us finalizing the lifestyle audit. And that process that will be able to sift out those that are trying to circumvent the system. Honorable Schreiber, with regard to the low conviction rate, fully agree that the information is readily available. You have payments that were made into this company that is owned by this director who's an employee of the state. The low conviction rate can be attributed to, now it means something is wrong when it comes to leading of that evidence before the jury or the person who would make a judgment, which we as PSC would be able or willing to reinforce if there is a disciplinary hearing and we are called to come and clarify the significance of the non-disclosure and how does it impact on service delivery to demonstrate the seriousness of the offense. Because if it is not articulated properly before a magistrate or before a disciplinary panel, there's bound to be an outcome that is not satisfactory. And many departments rely on labor relations officers. Sometimes they just want to get rid of the matter quickly without understanding the impact and the far-reaching implications of such decisions. I'm going to move on to Honorable Maluleka. Honorable Maluleka said we should share some good stories. There were many officials who registered on first in directorship of companies as well as on the central supplier database. But once that message went out of saying doing business with the state is being criminalized, it's now outlawed, we give you this period to make your choices, either deregister from companies and or stay with them, but disclose properly so that appropriate action can be taken. So many officials deregistered from companies which listed them as directors. And in some instances, you would have seen in our presentation, we say where EAs would be consulting with officials, there would be a response coming back saying the EA is satisfied with the response. In other instances, you will find deregistration is in progress. It has not been finalized by the company registration authority, but the official would have sent a letter and request that I'm deregistering as a director of this company. Please remove my name. So that's some of the things that we can share with you. But what a issue was raised relating to the deterrent effect of the conduct of officials who are not disclosing on time, who are not disclosing certain registrable interest. How we handle these matters as departments? determines the deterrent effect of our to other officials who would contravene this section. So there is a case currently ongoing of a head of department in the Northwest who undertook a trip somewhere to India and did not disclose with family, which was being paid by the service provider. So the evidence is overwhelming that forms part of its corruption, its gratification, because if this service provider is rendering service in your department and paid for your holiday trip, it is regarded as corruption. So it's work in progress. We are supporting the law enforcement in processing that case before the courts in the Northwest. So the outcomes from there will depending on what the judges have seen, what have we presented, we will use those as examples to other officials who will tend to violate our regulations. The reason for those who do not submit at all, most of them we find they either on suspension, others are on prolonged sick leave, what we call PLIR in the public service. But we have impressed with the departments to say even if a person is on suspension, the disclosures, they are made electronically. Nothing would prevent them from logging onto the system and disclosing their registrable interest. So we have this ongoing interactions with ethics officers in the department. We sometimes convene workshops just to go through some of the critical and prominent issues they must pay attention to. Honorable Musipe, on EA's need to act decisively, we agree with that. Our labor laws indicate that discipline is progressive. I've seen in a certain instance where we have repeat offenders, a department will start with a written warning, then it will follow the next disclosure cycle with a final written warning, then in the third year, then they institute a disciplinary action. But we agree that we need to have harsher sentences here or punishment that will deter others from committing the same offenses many times. So you need not even try to commit it once. The last one is once there was a question relating to disclosure of directorship by Honorable Maluleke. What then? If I've disclosed a directorship, what do you do? We take that information and run it parallel against the systems of government, payment systems of government, to check if there was any payment made to that company. And then we take it from there, because this is centralized. It's all data that is available in the domain of National Treasury, which they share with us, and then we will see that, oh, this company was paid. Then from there, we scrutinize and say it was an actual conflict of interest, or it was not disclosed, or the person had what do we call authorization to conduct business, but there's no. Currently, you cannot be authorized to conduct business with the state because that is a criminal offense. You can only be authorized to conduct business, but it should not have anything to do with the state. That's what we call other remunerative work. I'm going to pause here, but we will continue to engage with departments to share with them the best practices, the advices we get from these committees, in order that the management of these areas can be improved. And in so doing, it will improve good governance in the public sector. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you. Can okay. the department Chair, respond?
But Chair, before the department comes in, can I just clarify one last part that the TDG indicated? The issue of if officials are directors in companies and those companies are not conducting business with the state, the companies that the official own raises a potential conflict of interest in the sense that the state resources may be used by the official for the interest of that private company. Like, for example, time that the official is employed to, and then also the computers, the phones that are used for that private company. So it brings more pressure on departments to tightly monitor those officials who own companies which may or may, which may not be doing business with the state. I think that's an area that needs to be looked into. That officials need to put all their time to the department and not to the private companies that they own. Thank you.
This department can now respond.
Thank you, Chairperson.
Can I start then? You will follow a few things. And any official who's doing remunerative work outside the public service, but within a public servant, has to get a permission from the minister and the DG, and it's supposed to be like that. But Chair, thank you for the questions and the comments that the members of the portfolio committee have made, and we actually can pick up their frustration and the correct frustration on their part. Not on the good work or the absence of good work that we are doing, but I think of the subject itself. The fact that there are regulations that are saying to public servants, you shall not do so. And once you have that, the expectation is that then we don't have to sit here talking about public servants that are still breaching the law. And that frustration is justified because it is also our frustration. We should not be talking about this. We should be talking about what else must we add, because already all public servants are complying with these regulations. It's supposed to be like that. Not to say we still have public servants who are involved, who are doing these things. And I think I understand that. On the issue of officials who allege that politicians instruct them to do wrong things, I think the PFMA section 64 is very clear. If I instruct DG Yoliswa to do something that has financial implications and that is wrong, DG respectfully should request me to do that in writing. It doesn't give me a choice or her a choice. It says the section says it must be in writing. So it's not that it may, it must be in writing. And the DG has a responsibility, of course, on her side as an expert to advise the DM or the minister to say, DM or minister, this request has these implications financially. And that can actually lead to irregular expenditure or wasteful expenditure or whatever. If I insist, then I have got, she must then request me to do it in writing. and the DG has a responsibility to inform National Treasury and the Auditor General in terms of that section. So there are guidelines. It's not even guidelines. It's the law that should be followed. And of course, you will understand the fact that sometimes they will then say, if you do that, then you risk being, you know, contracts and so on and so forth. But I think it's the law. You better lose your job than not to follow the law. But of course, the very fact that we're not expecting these things, and that is why we employ DGs who are experts, but we also have DGs, financial officers who are expecting these things, who can advise even politicians so that their instructions are always within the law. I just want to mention that. And I think the chairperson of PSC and the representative of chairperson has responded on the issue related to the big elephant where officials will use their relatives. And I think that one was covered. I wanted to comment on that. But it actually tells you on the depth of this wrong attitude, as it was articulated correctly so by Honorable Ntuli, to say it shows the depth of this practice, which is so wrong. Remember, at some stage, people were allowed, in fact, there was nothing that was guiding them. But then it was said later, you can, but you must declare. But then it is now said, you cannot. It is an offense and a misconduct. So whilst we report these things to the police, to NPA, departments are expected to discipline these people. And if the information is there and there's wastage of time, wastage of resources, because if we go to court, it's not for free. There's money involved. Somebody must actually be found guilty and something serious must happen to that official who is deciding not to follow the law. Honorable Gondwe says EAs seem not to be interested or concerned about having an ethical public service. I take it that she makes those comments out of frustration because probably at this level, at portfolio committee level, we normally don't politic, we deal with issues. And I think she's saying it out of frustration. The reason why we're talking like this today, the reasons why we have these regulations, it's out of what we want to see happening in the public service, eliminating and excluding everything that has the potential to undermine the ethical conduct of our public servants. Mm-hmm. And that is why we have all these regulations. The reasons why the Portfolio Committee has invited us to come and explain these things is because all of us together with the Portfolio Committee and the actions that we are taking, the DG explained that the minister will want to address the faucet. Under normal circumstances, no minister will want to go and attend a meeting of managers. But out of wanting to take it to DGs himself, the minister has said, I will want you to put an item on this one so that I can come myself and address the DGs. And that tells you as to how serious we are, so that these things can be eliminated. We don't have to come to the Portfolio Committee to be talking about even two officials that are doing business with the state. We don't want that. And I want to agree fully with Honorable Gondwe when she says successful prosecution will serve as a deterrent. And surely it will. And that is why we hand over. And that is why we also have that interaction with SAPS, with NPA, with the Department of Justice, so that we can working together, see a day where these things will go to court. But of course, we are overloading courts that are already overloaded with things that are supposed not even to be happening, because public servants are supposed to know the law and they're supposed to know what they can and they cannot do. But I fully agree with her to say once we have these things taken to court and people found guilty and sentenced to whatever, that will serve as a deterrent. I fully agree with that one. On the issues raised by Honorable Ntuli, and I think we've responded to that, Honorable Mutsepe, to say officials, even if the minister is new, the officials are not new. And however, I think it has been explained that maybe things then get taken to offices of ministers who, when they are new in the department, will be overflooded with information, with documents that sometimes you're not even sure as to whether to sign or not sign. I do have sympathy on that one. However, it is also very true that the officials themselves will not be new, and they will show, therefore know things that they should prioritize for the new minister to say, this is what you need to attend first because it has got some closing dates, and if not, then will be found to have not met the deadlines. And on that score, I might sympathize with her. I'm more than willing, Honorable Mutsepe, to share with you my overview remarks and appreciate the fact that you found them to be helping. I will make them available because indeed they actually were prepared. But I think those are my comments, and I will allow the DG to respond on the technical questions. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Deputy Minister. I think the Deputy Minister has covered a number of issues, Chairperson, as well as the Public Service Commission, because these issues are really interrelated. There was an issue around naming and shaming that was raised, and our view as the department is that we have shared the information to the committee in terms of the departments that are involved and etc. We are not in a position to issue names of the people at this stage because these are still allegations. So until at a point where the allegations have been confirmed through investigations and they go through those processes, the law enforcement processes, we have a little bit of a constraint there in terms of specifically sharing the names. But any other information associated with this, we are able to share. There was also a case in respect to clarity on cases where public servants were doing business with the state, not found guilty internally. I think Dr. Solomon, I would like him to speak in detail on this, but from my side, I understand that some of these cases, the reports, the departments do not give us the detail, but maybe he may have a little bit of insight in respect to that. In terms of the breakdown figures per province, we've provided the figures, but what we have not done is to show directly next to each province or national department the cases that have been resolved or cases that are in progress, because there are such a few number of cases. But we will certainly reorganize that information in that context if the committee wishes so. I think the issue raised around the use of relatives, yes, it would be difficult through this process of the department to get to that extent. But as the colleague from PSC was indicating, when you do proper detailed investigations, your lifestyle audits, you may be able to track the trail of the money and where it finally lands. I've seen with some of the investigations the SIU has done in relation to the PPE that they've been able to pick up where there's also been involvement of some relatives and et cetera. And these issues have been widely reported in media as well. Unwillingness of departments to cooperate leads to challenge. Yes, I mean, I think that there's a challenge of compliance, and maybe there's a bigger root cause that we need to deal with. Maybe there's a lot of things that we're putting out there for compliance to departments, so they are unable to focus in terms of compliance. So we've also been doing our own reflection internally as DPSA. What are the regulations that are having an impact that we need to focus on strengthening and work with departments around? Because there is a sense that there are departments that are truly not complying, and it doesn't matter what you do. I have spoken to the DGs myself. I have presented to Foresight myself the report on financial disclosures. We have taken it to the last Foresight in February. I have written so many letters. Yes, honorable members, the letters have deadlines, but when DGs do not respond to the deadlines, the next escalation mechanism for me is to take the matters to the minister. So in this case, the minister intervenes and speaks to the executive authorities and speaks to all those that are concerned. So the minister has now asked to say he wants to also go and address PESAL. He wants to go and address FOSAD. And one of the interventions that we are doing, you'd see in our APP, we have an annual compliance report that we want to publish. So these issues around compliance, we're also going to address them as part of the annual compliance report we're going to publish. We will be doing this annual compliance report for the first time in the current financial year. And I think it's going to, in the manner that we're going to do, I think it's going, our hope is that it's going to encourage people to look at these issues of compliance, because I think there's no DG who wants to see their name being published as having non-complied to such critical regulations. Yes, the failure, Honorable Schreiber, by some of the departments is a very serious issue for us, and we agree on the political unplugging, and we've already escalated these matters to the minister. The issues around conviction rate, I don't know, I think Dr. Solomon can speak to that, but also I think SAPS must really come together with NPA, because we are working with them in the same platform. They should be able to come and speak to the committee in confidence about what are the issues. Maybe they're experiencing challenges that they are unable to share with us. From our side, as DPSA, we have availed resources that we have availed whatever capability that we have, including information, and SAPS, they also have information from the PSC and et cetera. So they need to indicate what is making it so difficult for them to move. We had also asked that there must be a dedicated unit which in SAPS that centralizes and track these cases. I don't know if that dedicated unit is there, but I am aware that there's at least people who have been delegated this responsibility who are in constant communication with us as DPSA. We are concerned some of the cases, I think there's about 78 cases confirmed which involve SAPS members. And out of those 78 cases, I think there's only about 5 or 7 that are in progress, even from SAPS. So it is a matter of concern for us. In terms of, yes, the SSA declarations were of the same view that these are personal declarations, and colleagues at the State Security Agency should be able to declare. The view and the decision that says they are not going to declare because they'll put the country in danger. We are not sure how the country can be put in danger through declaring your personal, how many cars you own, how many houses you own, and all these particular issues that we declare as individuals. In terms of the ethics officers training, I think Dr. Solomon can speak in detail to that training, but this training, as I understand it, was also provided by SAPS because we had to prepare the officers and our ethics officers in terms of the work, the processes that they need to follow. Should there be a need for training by other entities, as suggested, like the NPA, I think that the colleagues can go into detail in relation to that particular issue. The discrepancy in figures, please, Dr. Solomon, speak on it. I will leave that particular issue to you as well. Are we giving departments deadlines? Yes, certainly we are giving the departments deadlines. Some of them meet the deadline, some of them do not meet the deadlines. Need for convention and throw people in prison, we truly agree. Our engagements with SAPS have really been about let's move, let's have case studies for people to know that I should not be doing business with the state, or I should not be conducting business with the state as a public servant because I will end up in jail. But the criminal justice system has its own life and its own way of doing things, which sometimes is not as fast as we wish it should be in terms of dealing with these particular matters. So we are in agreement in relation to that. And there is law that really empowers SAPS to do what needs to be done in this respect. Then there was, I think, Honorable Maluleke, the concern of 98% SMS declaration. We agree we should be at 100%. There is quite a number of departments nationally that are also at 100%. And but there's still departments that are not at 100%, and we have presented to FOSA, to the Forum of DGs, and to give feedback to the DGs and to ask them to really ensure that their officials to declare, but at the end, the responsibility for a declaration rests with the officials. The ethics officer do give reminders once the system is open. We do give reminders. We send information to officials. But at the end, it's really a personal responsibility for the official to create time, to go into the website, and to do the declaration that is required. So from a point of view of measures to ensure all officials comply, the one issue for me that's outstanding is the commitment of the officials. Those who do not declare, it's their own commitment to the process that is outstanding. But from a point of capability, the capability is there for colleagues to declare. Can the system detect whether companies are doing, whether people are doing business with the state? I think this was a question from the PSC, but just to say there's lots of analysis that PSC gets done, does on the cases, and we work with them as well from DPSA. So they also have the other third parties that they work with to verify the information that we submit. Suspension without pay in relation to those who may be repeat offenders, I think this is an issue we would like to take to our legal unit to further give us advice on it. We will not be able at this stage to give a yes or no in that. And then there was an issue around warning letters and access to the overview or by DM. Okay, the warning letters issue, I think that the colleague from PSC also answered in a pointed manner, and I agree with that response. Chair, the few issues that I've forwarded to Dr. Solomon, I would like to request that he be given that opportunity. From our side, I'm done with the responses. Thank you, Chair.
Is Dr. Solomon coming?
Thank you, Chair. I think I just want to start by thanking the honourable members for their words of encouragement, because this is a serious work and it's a difficult work, but it's also exciting work because we know we are really changing the way that public service is working by doing this work. So to address the first issue of Honourable Lesoma, the issue of the statistics to look at comparisons, we have drafted two documents which I can make available to the portfolio committee. The one is a statistical report which indicates from 2019 to 2021. So that would give a good overview of the progress made. And then there's also a second report, it's the investigation report, where we then take each department and indicated what the feedback was, what we received from them. So that we can make available. Then around the clarity of the issue where departments indicated cases finalized and found not guilty. This is in cases where it was established that the employee is not a public service member, or the person was wrongly appointed on the partial, or where the person was actually appointed in official capacity. But I must also indicate that the responses that we got from the departments is not very detailed. So that is one thing that we want to change and correct going forward, so that when a department, for example, indicate that they have laid criminal charges, that they can give us a case number, that they can give us the police official which they reported it to. And the same with the disciplinary hearings, because those disciplinary hearings should also be reported to the DPSA, so that we can also establish the veracity of the investigations and the outcome thereof. So that is one of the tasks that we will take forward from this day forward. Then regarding the comments of Honorable Tebekulu, there's always ways and means to bypass a system. And the one thing that gives me some hope is if there is proper investigation of cases, when the police investigate, they will find the fronting elements where you register people that your family members or friends, and then through the criminal process, that will be unearthed. So even if there's a lifestyle audit process which will kick in later, we also need to rely on all the methods and the tools that we have available to make sure that people do not bypass the system. Now, regarding the issue of Honorable Schreiber, the conviction rate, I think DDG McPlatsy spoke at length around the conviction rate. But one of the issues that I can highlight is if the departments do not investigate, then the police cannot start with the criminal investigations. And we already experience difficulty of getting information out of the departments. So if we can improve that point of entry, the responses of the departments, it will definitely impact on the conviction rate as well, because then the SAPs will have cases to convict. That is just additional information or my comments apart from what DDG McClatsy already spoke to. Then, Honorable Kondwe, on the issue of the ethics officers getting trained, the training focus was on training them on how to investigate. And the police did an excellent job in this regard to take them through all the processes, indicating what the type of evidence is that they should look at, assisting them on how to draft affidavit and the process that is required. And they also touched on the issue of what the NPA's role would be. So there was no need to involve the NPA directly because the SAPs took part of that. But I do take note of your comment that we should also involve the NPA in that process going forward. Then, Honorable Pondwe, on your issue of the discrepancy of the information, the SAPs found in September 2020 that based on the 1,539 cases they received from the DPSA based on 2020's central database information, they sanitized that information, and by September they found that of that, if they distilled and looked at the information, there's 579 left that they can work on. But the information, the 484, is which we then looked at in January. So it means that there was actually a decrease from September to January, where that 580 or so fizzled down to 484, which is then the amount that we left with now in January 2021. But of course, those information still need to be verified through the investigative process to see whether those people actually did do business with the state. So in terms of the deadlines for investigations, the DPSA cannot prescribe to the SAPs what time they must take to do investigations. But what we did agree to is we will have quarterly meetings between us to see that there's no where there's challenges that we can unblock the challenges and move forward so that we do keep with timelines, that cases are not dragged for time immemorial. The SAPs do have some dedicated people that I speak to regularly that provide me with updates, but I think the processes on their side, I cannot speak on their behalf, where it would be better to request them to provide information on their role and the investigations itself. Then my last input would be to respond to Honorable Motsepe, where she indicated that there may be some policy or regulation shortcomings that we need to look at, and I want to fully agree with Honorable Motsepe. The Technical Assistance Unit also has the mandate to look at norms and standards on ethics and integrity in the public service. And as we experience challenges and as we see certain things unfold or look at ways how to improve the system, we will definitely take that up and include that in future regulations and policies to improve the system so that going forward we eliminate this challenge that we currently experience. Thank you, Honourable Chair. I think that's all from my side.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members. Thank you, DM. Thank you, Public Service Commission, and everybody who has contributed to this meeting today. We have come now to the end of the meeting. I therefore want to adjourn this meeting. Sir. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you very much. Sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Sir?
Thank you.
Hello. Yes, I'm listening.
Long live Honorable Gond.
There is still a presentation from...
is there an outstanding presentation?
Yes.
There's still a presentation.
Yes.
From?
DPSA on the Government Employees Housing Scheme.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Sorry for that. I'm in a rush.
It's housing scheme, sir, from...
yeah, housing scheme. Yes. DM, who's doing that presentation?
DG Will.
Yes. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a colleague from the unit who has been delegated to present. Her name is Kelly Mkonto. She's an acting chief director. Kelly, please, over to you. May I ask Kelly that we don't go through the detail of the presentation because it's quite long, and I think the members are pressed for time for other activities that they have. But over to you, Kelly.
Okay, thank you, DG. I don't know in terms of the screen, do I share the presentation or someone is controlling the presentation?
And the host guide on the matter, please. Okay, you can share.
Okay, I've shared the presentation. Can you all see it?
Yes. And please put it on presentation format, Kelly. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, DG, and thank you, Honourable Members, and also the DM. Thank you, and thank you the Honourable Chair and colleagues. Good afternoon. I'm just trying to see if I can also share the because I'm trying to show my video and it's not showing. Okay. In terms of the presentation, I'll follow the following presentation outline. I'll just briefly touch on the introduction and give a brief background and the share on the new implementation strategy and the progress on the housing allowance. And then talk to challenges and how we are addressing the challenges, and then cover the conclusion. I'm pressing DG now. It's not moving. I don't know what's happening. Okay. The issue of home ownership is a challenge across the country. It's the challenge that affects a number of individuals. Public servants are also faced with the similar challenges, and government and labor agreed that the historic housing allowance dispensation did not really translate into improvement in home ownership, and hence when they did the analysis in 2015, they discovered that 70% of government employees who were getting this housing allowance were not really owning homes. Then the two agreed to establish GHS. It was established in as part of the PSCBC resolution of 7 in 2015. And the main focus really of the GHS is to introduce and enhance the housing allowance that enforces compulsory savings by employees. And also we involved in negotiating favorable terms with both financial and housing suppliers and introduce new services such as debt rehabilitation and debt counseling. As I indicated, it was established as part of Resolution 7 of 2015. But the key main objectives are to support, educate, and advise employees on housing opportunities, enhance employees' access to affordable housing, promote home ownership, and facilitate asset security amongst government employees, and also assist employees to access affordable housing loans and finance, and assist employees who rent houses with a view to buy by assisting them with savings. And these are the four pillars that we'll be focusing on. The first pillar focuses on housing allowance administration. The next one is employee empowerment, housing finance, housing supply and stakeholder management. We have started implementing four of the key pillars that we have identified here. We still have a challenge with the housing supply, but we'll be working on it in the new financial year. Now, in terms of the GHS since inception, and the DPSA has since inception of the resolution created a ring-fenced funded project management office additional to the DPSA to implement the resolution. However, we later really incorporated the functions of the of GHS into DPSA's function. We'll talk to that later. Establish an enrollment system. And we also established a call center where HR specialists, HR practitioners call in for assistance, and also individuals who call in for assistance in terms of their savings. Provided education and support programs for employees and departments. And we've collaborated with National Treasury. They are managing our ILSF system. And also collaborated with other finance institutions, facilitated home loans for eligible employees, and managed and maintained the ILSF. The last part is an ongoing a process. Now, in addressing these, the DPSA has institutionalized functions within the approved structures of DPSA. Like I indicated earlier on, that it was additional, but later it was institutionalized within DPSA. And the functions, I have alluded to these functions earlier, that's housing allowance administration, including ILSF, stakeholder management, education and outreach, client support services, housing finance, and facilitating the availability of housing stock. And in terms of the strategy, we came up with a vision and mission. Really, the key vision really is to make sure that government employees access affordable quality housing for all public servants. Now, in terms of the strategic outcomes, we're focusing on promotion of home ownership and efficient data management regarding the ILSF, employee empowerment, inclusive participatory and competitive housing finance solution, housing supply based on economies of scales, and optimized partnership with public and private sector stakeholders. Now, just a brief progress. The scheme is for level 1 to 10 government employees, and they are currently getting an allowance of 1,456. And it increases on an annual basis based on the CPI index. The employees who are not owning nor renting any accommodation do not receive the housing allowance. So here, you know, for employees to qualify, they need to apply and also enroll on the system for them to actually enjoy the benefits of GHS. Employees who are homeowners receive the full housing allowance as an additional to their monthly salary. It's not a deduction. It's not like it's they have to pay an extra amount. It's an additional payment to their housing allowance. The housing allowance amount is adjusted. I spoke to that in line with the average CPI index of the previous year. Employees who are on middle management and senior management, that is level 11 housing allowance. However, they need to enroll for them to actually enjoy the benefits. We have assisted the number of employees who are, you know, over 11 to 14, who have come to us for assistance in terms of access to loans, counseling, and debt rehabilitation. Employees who are living in rented accommodation, these are tenants, have their housing allowance or portion of it saved in ILSF. This ILSF is managed, we co-manage it together with National Treasury. Now, employees who joined the system after the finalization of the PSCB resolution, they do not get their money paid into their PESL. The money, all of it is saved. So that whole 1,456 is saved for them in preparation for buying a house. And then those who actually joined before the closure, because they started enjoying the 900 rents, it was decided that they'll continue receiving the 900 rents. However, the balance, that is the balance between the 1,456 and 900, the balance, which is 556, will be saved for them on ILSF. And on the day they are ready and they're tired of renting, they have approval from the banking institutions, they can access ILSF funding, and that money will assist them as a deposit. Employees who are living in rental accommodation, okay, they only withdraw their savings for the purpose of acquiring a home, building, or improving a home. Otherwise, they are not allowed to access the funding. And hence, I said it's important for employees to enroll and also apply for housing allowance, because you'll see later on, I'll speak to a number of people who are not enjoying this benefit. And these are people from level 1 to 10 who are not enjoying the benefit because it's either they do not know or they are not owning, they are not renting a facility, they are not renting, and they are also probably not even interested, you know, with the housing allowance that is given to public servants. Now, in September 2018, the determination, an amended determination and directive on housing allowance in the public service was issued, which addressed the delinking of the allowance. That is, spouses, they can actually both receive the housing allowance. Employees are assisted throughout all the stages of securing home ownership, and they are also educated. I spoke to that earlier on. The number of employees receiving housing allowance as homeowners increased from what is that number, because I can't see it now on the screen, but it increased to 710,173 as at January 31st, 2020. The increase is over, it's an increase of over 17,000, and it shows that people are enjoying this benefit, because it's a comparison of June last year to January. Just in 6 months, we've seen an increase of 17,000. Now, as at 31st January, the number of employees receiving housing allowance as tenants also decreased, which is a positive for us in that people are beginning to want to buy houses instead of renting. So the number is going down, and we're hoping that it will go down further before the end of the financial year. and accumulated savings are held in interest-bearing facility, the one that is that we co-manage with National Treasury until such time that employees are ready to access the funds for the purposes of acquiring a home, building, or improving their homes. These savings shall only be accessed for the purposes of acquiring, I don't have to repeat that, I spoke to that earlier. And then the next slide really just gives a breakdown of the consolidated number of withdrawals from inception till June 2020. We get this on an annual basis from National Treasury. I guess the next consolidation will be done in June 2021. These are the numbers. It shows that the number from ILSF have 200 over 200,000 employees. And you'll see in the previous slide, we talked of 249, but it's those who, they probably withdrew the money to improve their houses, but they probably already had houses. And in terms of the clause of 4.0 of the PSCBC Resolution 7 of 2015, clause 4.1.21, it's important for employees to enroll for them to enjoy the benefits. It's a challenge that we are experiencing now that a number of them are not aware of this enrollment. And in support of the above, an enrollment system which enables the profiling of the employee housing choices. You see, when they enroll, it assists us also when we do an analysis on the payments, on the performance of the scheme and the number of people that are enjoying the benefits, and also in terms of reducing the numbers as well of people who need to own houses. The DPSA is engaged in a process to ensure a systematic link between enrollment center, MOJEC origination, and access to finance and housing supply. So if we have these numbers, if these people are enrolled on the system, it makes our job a lot easier when we approach partners and finance institutions and housing stock entities, because, you know, we're still battling with housing stock. But if we have the numbers and people are enrolled, and we can actually just analyze the trends in terms of housing needs, it assists us to access this info. Now, as at 31st January 2021, only 41,000, close to 342 government employees are enrolled, of which 135,537 have title deeds. And we are only able to analyze this once individuals are enrolled, because, you know, the enrollment system has quite a number of questionnaires that they need to populate, and we also just manage to follow the trends of performance. Now, as at 30 December, in terms of mortgage-based products, we managed to get information from SA Home Loan that we had over 18,258 GHS-linked home loans to the value of over 12 billion. And we also have non-mortgaged based products. These are products that range from 70,000 to 300,000, where you don't need to pay legal costs, transfer costs. And people who access this in the main are people who are involved with their PTOs, which is permission to occupy, where, you know, they actually just access the funds from ILSF and also maybe even from the banks to actually augment whatever building plans that they have already started in their communities. And now, just to quickly run through the GHS programs, we have appropriate location of the GHS Advisory Council. In the PSCBC resolution indicated that there is a need for an advisory council, and we also picked up, you know, as we started with the implementation of this advisory council, that it was just not possible for us to actually follow what was outlined in the PSCBC resolution. And we managed to get the chief law advisor recommendations, and we shared the recommendations with the with the PSCBC, and we are now finalizing the consultative forum where six members will be identified by the employer and the other six will be identified by labor. The other program is on the finance-linked individual savings program, which is FLIPS. This is in partnership with the Department of Human Settlements entity, which is the National Housing Finance Corporation. We are in the process of really just finalizing the MOU in this regard, because this will also benefit government employees in terms of accessing the subsidies that are available out there. You probably all know that FLIPS is not only for government employees, it's for all the employees that are, that earn between 3,500 rands. And now the advantage with this is that they also increase the ceiling now from 15,000 to 22,000. So they get the money, the subsidy ranges between 27,000 to 121,000, depending on the salary band of the individuals that apply for FLIPS subsidy. The DPSA and DHS are exploring collaboration. This one is actually, we're hoping that this process will be finalized before end of February. Now, the introduction of pension-backed home loans. This is really a huge milestone in that, you know, government employees, others, they want houses, but, you know, when you look at their financial standing, it's just not good enough. So now if they have the support of GPF, where they actually back their application, it assists us as well, even the people who are really working in GHS, to negotiate favorable rates, you know, for the employees, because at least they know, banks will know that the payment will be is backed by their pensions. The significance of pension back home loans is that many banks are prepared to lend money and to employees challenged because of their financial standing. The other one is the research on the use of ILSF funding. We have saved a lot of money. Actually, as we speak now, this money is sitting, this was in December, it was 9.8, but end of January, we received figures, but they indicated that they still want to verify one or two things. Hence, we're just speaking to the figure that we are completely sure of, that is 9.8 billion as at end of 31 December 2020. We are Treasury is sitting with an amount of over 9.8 billion. And now we felt that maybe this is also another avenue that we could actually explore as GHS to see as to whether we cannot use this as a financing vehicle for those who want to access funding. That is, if banks are unable to actually assist those who want to access the funding, maybe we should explore ways of accessing this additional funding to assist government employees. And then also we're facilitating availability of housing stock. I indicated earlier on in terms of the pillars that I referred to that this is one area that really needs special focus. So a study to determine the role of GHS in facilitating the availability of housing stock will be conducted in the next financial year. And we're hoping that also as we engage with public works, this would also assist us in identifying housing stock that is very close to people's work and you know, they save on transport, and you find that housing stock is available, but it's quite remote for quite a number of government employees. So we're hoping that as we explore this area, we'll be able to identify housing stock that would really be convenient for government employees. Now, in terms of the partners that we're forging to, we're hoping to engage with, and the ones that we are also already working with, if we have partnerships with GPF, we have on pension bank guaranteed homes, Department of Human Settlement in terms of FLIPS, We have labor, because obviously, you know, GHS was established in partnership with labor in 2015. We have housing finance institutions. We are currently engaging with housing development agency in terms of land and really negotiating better rates for government employees. We have national and provincial departments. And like I indicated, we are still in discussion phase with the public works regarding housing stock infrastructure. Now, in terms of the challenges, delays in incorporating the GHS as a functional unit within DPSA created, you know, this was actually also challenged by the budget constraints that we had. But now, like I indicated earlier on, now GHS is actually a DPSA program. It's been incorporated. We have a chief directorate responsible for government employee housing scheme. During the period of reporting, I spoke to this earlier, we have over 217 government officials that are not enjoying the benefits of the GHS benefits. And it also includes employees who have not applied for housing allowance. Employees transferred across, this is the other challenge, you know, the multi-systems that we use. Employees transferred across multiple systems. We have SASA that uses Oracle, and we have PERSOL that is being used by Defense. And we find that, you know, when employees move from one department to the other, the information has to be captured manually. And that poses huge risks. And but we are engaging with the three entities as well in terms of just looking at how we can actually make sure that the three systems interface with each other. I know with PERSOL, it might actually take a while, but there are engagements already with SASA. A transfer of employees between systems, okay, I spoke to that. Now, earlier when we started, we identified 70% of, over 70% of government employees were getting housing allowance. Now the number has actually decreased to 35%. You know, when we started, we had over 70% of government employees who did not own homes. When it started in 2015. But now we want to get this number down, but currently we have 35% of employees who are receiving housing allowance and are still not homeowners. This is due to a number of factors which are really alluded to those factors. And they are unable to get housing finance, and the houses are not affordable, and there is also poor supply. If we can really just kickstart this housing stock responsibility, it would really assist a number of government employees in terms of accessing housing that is within their affordability range. The workshops, okay. You know, COVID has really assisted us in really trying to really plan and think outside the box. However, there are areas that are really not easy to reach via virtual means, especially, you know, the because it's government, it's all government employees. You know, the school districts and some districts, they just do not have connectivity. And it's a bit of a challenge to actually just engage with their HR practitioners there, because the HR practitioners are a key link in making sure that this program works. They need to make sure that when they onboard their officials, they apply for housing allowance, they fill in the correct form, they enroll on the system, they educate them about the benefits of being enrolled and what they can actually access by enrolling with the GHS. There is therefore a need to explore modalities on how to facilitate access to affordable housing, affordable housing in appropriate location. And HR practitioners do not capture employees on time or provide employees with documents when they exit. It's important. This is actually a key challenge that we're dealing with, that HR practitioners do not really give employees the relevant documents when they exit, and by the time they want to access their benefits, the system has already kicked them out. DHS is trying to resolve cases where employees who have exited, this is actually a work in progress. We're trying to assist because the list is just unbelievable, and we felt maybe there is a need to address this. According to the latest report, 17,442 employees were declined loans. Others, they have garnishing orders, and others do not have a deposit, or their credit score does not really assist them. Now, in terms of addressing the challenges, I spoke to this one of finalizing the institutional form of GHS. The GHS supports, we're also supporting HR practitioners and finance practitioners, both in at provincial and national level. And we have also improved with the turnaround time to resolve employees' inquiries. Some inquiries really are resolved immediately, but others would take 5 to 10 days, and others even take much longer. However, there is we've got now a full dedicated team of officials that are attending to these matters. Some inquiries require HR interventions in department, which may take longer than the turnaround time. The team assists clients through telephones. I spoke to the establishment of a call center earlier on. We also respond to emails, and then we also have walk-ins as well, where we have face-to-face interactions. And this is actually especially when it comes to government employees. But with HR practitioners, we've developed standard operating procedures for them, and we also have developed a training manual for HR practitioners, because we have realized that it is actually a critical need in most departments. Now, the process for consolidating and integrating the enrollment system, origination and access to affordable housing is underway. We need to really just speedily come up with a business case in this regard. And in conclusion, the access to and provision of decent housing is a national imperative, and it really needs immediate attention. It is envisaged that the new implementation strategy and the operating model might assist in addressing these challenges. Thank you.
Thank you, Kelly. Move yourselves now.
Yeah. I'm trying to do this. How do I get off?
Okay.
Yeah.
Stop screen share, Kelly.
Yeah, okay. Is it gone? I've removed
it. Yes, it is gone. It is gone, Shelley. Thank you very much. Honorable members, apologies for prematurely ending the meeting with this item still outstanding. Can I get members who want to discuss on this item? I see Honorable Soma and Honorable Mutsipe.
Honorable Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity. I think others, they say wait and see. But nevertheless, let me do it now. And yes, Honorable Chair, because of my barrage band that is showing behind me, let me switch off my video. Through your permission. Thank you very much.
It's a barrage, you know.
Hey, hi, no song, kidnap.
Kidnap.
Let me close the video. I'm requesting to close the video. Thank you. Thanks very much, Honorable Chair, and also let me appreciate the presentation. Probably, Chair, one would say that the way it's being presented, notwithstanding the administrative challenges that may be the department has, but it's not so much encouraging. I will tell you why. We always say that we are a very caring government, especially the Republic of South Africa government. It's a very caring one. But the way we treat this issue is like it's one of those, by the way. But also I was worried when the presenter speaks as if this item is for the first time. Probably I will borrow from her words. She said, if we can kickstart this scheme, and I got worried in her process when she borrowed those words, that what does that mean? But nevertheless, Chair, let me just go straight to my questions. The very most important one is that the scheme, it was responding to the missing middle. In terms of house ownership or home ownership, public servants, as it were. And the way we are dealing with it, it doesn't seem like it wants to respond to that. Why I'm saying that, Chair, one is the issue that those ones who doesn't meet the threshold of the borrowings or the credit score, they don't meet the credit score. Then it doesn't say what do we do. The president didn't talk to that. Because also what also this one was trying to respond to, taking from the history, was that our public servants employees, I want to be narrow to just to focus on them, is that they are very much indebted. And they end up not having money to acquire decent shelter for themselves because they belong to the missing middle, because they can't also get the government subsidized homes, which we term them RDP houses and all that. Hence, I'm saying that I'm not so encouraged with the progress thus far. But also the other one is that with the financial institutions that are being set here, their interest rates are very high. I thought the housing scheme, was also going to try to do that. Your PIC and your GPEF also, in terms of their bank charges, are very high, which means then they make you more poorer than yesterday. And I thought the department was going to assist us to say how do we best assist those missing middle, as it were. But also the second one for me, Chair, is that probably it's a take-home one, this point that I'm going to raise now. There's this a mega scheme in Pretoria that the President spoke about, which was launched last year. If then government can also see how can we also see our public employees benefit from that, because I know that government also have contributed there in terms of investing in the infrastructure, underground infrastructure, which it is responsibility as government to invest. But for the top structure as a battering one to say if there are those ones who are interested, because if you go and study the Rwanda model, it does in a way respond to what we intend to do. The other one, Chair, that I would like to ask is that the pension back home loan financing involves the GEPF. It's a guarantee, but also it says that then we're saying our employees must then tap in their pension before they even retire and also enjoy that pension fund. I'm not too sure why we opted for that, but also it says that it reminds me, which is a by the way issue, which has got nothing to do with this one. It's because also the GEPF. Probably let's also, in one of the good days, Chair, with your permission, of course, is to get a status progress and a financial standing of the stand of SACA. I've heard in the news that they have also been able to recoup some of the funds and all that. And how much then is going to be paid back to the GEPF, the money that has been sent in that Stanwolf saga, as it were. In terms of the GEHS, you know, the Advisory Council Chair, where the members of the Advisory Council, which the department is the mainstream employees of the department, are recruited from outside specifically for the purpose. Now, that legal requirement are that they must be located within the public service, the PSCBC. What is going to happen to those ones, employees who are outside that, but also who are public employees, public government, public service employees? If one can get the clarity on that. And also when we counsel our employees in terms of advising and educating them on the scheme, do they indicate why some are still reluctant to own houses and prefer to rent? But it's a personal choice. But also on this one, the presenter spoke about that we are unable to interact with the HR practitioners of various departments, as it were. But I would have loved the presenter to appreciate that. The COVID-19, the scheme was before that. And then it still talks about the interest of those employees who doesn't then, who still invest on the housing scheme, but also their money, they are not utilizing it. Who benefits from the interest of that? Probably the other questions, Chair, so that I don't speak long. But I'll just ask the last two questions. After the introduction of the scheme strategy, is there any increased uptake scheme of that? Because you have now introduced a new strategy that intended to do that, which is linked to say why then our employees are reluctant to take the scheme, as it were, because it's their money anyway, especially those ones who are investing in it in terms of the money that gets deposited to the scheme. Chairperson, with that, the other questions will follow in writing, but one will really appreciate moving forward that we should be seen also having interest to our public servants or owning the houses, as it were, or having a decent shelter as it were, because they are in a missing meeting, and we don't want to create homeless people, unintended homeless people, because also they are FIR enacted as well. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mzipe.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson. Yeah, I would like to ask this question that the department, the debt rehab plus debt counseling, how is the department assisting these employees in terms of these two issues? Number two, employees who are not owning or renting any accommodation does not receive housing allowance. Which criteria do you use to determine this issue? Because really, they are also the employees of the they are also public servants. Why don't they get this allowance? And then the third question, spouses are both receiving housing allowance. Do they get equal benefit if they are married, is the question. And then I've got the recommendation here. Why don't the department make necessary arrangements or amending some other legislation in order to make all the employees to qualify for housing scheme or loans? Because really to have house and working in the Department of Government is where the employees feel secured, and the housing allowance does not even make them own houses because it is still little. And the worst part, not everyone do get that allowance and they must get the decent houses. To get a decent house is not a privilege, it is a right. Thank you so much, Honorable Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Mutipa. Can we get a response now from the question raised?
Okay.
Chair, I have my hand up.
Andre, I see your hand. You raised it late. I see it now. Okay. Take the platform, Honorable Kondwe.
Yeah, let's do it. Let me start by thanking DPSA for their presentation. My questions are basically three questions. The first one is, in the presentation, they indicate that as of the 31st of January 2021, the number of employees receiving housing allowances, tenants, decreased. I want to find out whether the decrease in the number of employees receiving housing allowance is linked to the increase in the number of employees receiving housing allowances as homeowners. I just want to find out what the cause for the decrease in the number of employees receiving housing allowances as tenants is. My second question is, I just want a confirmation, an idea of the total number of government employees that qualify for this housing allowance, and how many of these employees are currently receiving that housing allowance, either as tenants or as homeowners, because yes, I know you indicated that approximately 700,000 are receiving housing allowances as homeowners, and approximately 240,000 are receiving housing allowances as tenants. And then you also indicate that 217 do not receive a housing allowance either because they are not owning a house or renting a house. So I just want to get a full figure around how many employees are actually making use of qualify for the scheme, and how many are actually benefiting from the scheme either as tenants or homeowners. And then you further indicated that 35% of employees receiving housing allowances do not own houses. Now, just to piggyback on what Honorable Lesoma said, what are you intending to do about that? And what are your recommendations around improving that? Because, you see, one of the objectives of the scheme is to promote home ownership and to facilitate asset security amongst employees of government. And if you have, 35% of employees, possibly qualifying for that, for the scheme and not making use of it, then this defeats the purpose of this objective. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Honorable Kondwe. Can we get responses now to the question raised?
Thank you, Chairperson. Deputy Minister, I don't know if you want to start first.
You can go ahead. Maybe to mention, Chair, that indeed there are challenges, there will be challenges in schemes such as this one. However, what makes us happy is the fact that we're now talking about a scheme that is being implemented. So we're no longer at a primary level. We're dealing with challenges at a secondary level to say what are the challenges of implementing the scheme. Indeed, there are shortcomings here and there, and we are attending to them. We're having meetings with PIC, with the National Treasury, with ourselves. We're looking at everything about the contract itself, but about everything else in the scheme, so that the public servant, as Honorable Lesoma is saying, does achieve its own objectives. The very fact that it was meant to address the public servants who were and who continue to be the missing middle, and therefore do not qualify for government RDP houses, but also cannot get loans from banks because of their indebtedness. We are actually attending to that, working together with even unions. We're meeting with them, we're getting feedback from them, and we're attending to some of the problems. I think I just want to say that, however, the scheme is there, and we're trying every day to improve it. Thank you. DG?
Thank you, Deputy Minister. Clearly, I'm going to ask that you first deal with some of the questions because they are quite operational in terms of the information that is required. So over to you, Kelly.
Okay. Thank you, DK. And thank you for the questions asked as well. Where do I start now with the question? Because they knew that the number of
of the total number of government employees that are supposed to get a home allowance. We have over 700,000 employees. If I'm not sure if I'm responding to that question properly. We have over 700 employees, and I indicated in my presentation that we have over 249 that are receiving this the allowance as tenants. And when I said the number has increased, it therefore tells us a good story that we're having more government officials now owning houses, that they have moved. They have accessed the funding from ILSF, and others have also qualified from the FLIP subsidy, that they access their savings, and they also managed to get a subsidy from FLIPs, and that would really assist them in putting down deposits towards their houses. So the number has increased in terms of home ownership. When the tenants decrease, the number of home ownership increases. And Madam also mentioned the other a challenge in terms of those that are not renting and owning houses. Why are they not benefiting? It was clearly stipulated that it's important for government employees who fall within that band of 1 to 10 that they actually apply for housing allowance. And we have discovered that most of them are not doing that. They're not taking advantage of really applying for the housing allowance. You'd recall we mentioned that before 2015, people used to get this housing allowance, but they did not have houses. However, from 2015, we said it's important for them to apply for housing allowance. For them to enjoy the benefit, they need to apply and also enroll on the GHS system. So you find that a number of them are not, it's either they are not aware of these benefits, or maybe there's just no interest. We are currently investigating all these causes, but what we have actually identified as a key challenge was that a number of them are not aware that they need to register for them to actually enjoy the housing allowance benefit. And then in terms of the other question was around the pension-backed allowance. It does not mean when they say pension-backed, it acts as a guarantee that should they really default on paying their houses, at least there is a backup, but it does not necessarily mean it will really eat up their pension fund. It actually just assists in negotiating better interest rates for some government officials, because some banks, they need guarantees to say, you know, one of the the honorable member indicated earlier on, a number of them are really hugely indebted and the money is just not enough and they just cannot make ends meet. But if there is this guarantee that says, you know, this is a member that we know and their salary is deducted and here's a payslip and here is assurance of the pension that we should they default on their payments, at least there is a backup. But it does not necessarily mean it will be accessed immediately. It is only accessed only if they struggle to pay with the monthly payments. I think I've answered most of the operational questions, DJ.
Thank you, Kelly. I think that a few of the issues I would have wanted to say in answering questions, Chair, is just to say that the strategy that we just presented the pillars of was approved, I think, about three months ago. So the process of rolling out that strategy has already started. And yes, there are engagements at the level of the PSCBC between the unions and the particularly, in fact, even outside the PSCBC, between the unions and the executive authority of the department on these particular matters. the labor has really communicated what some of the expectations and interests are in respect to this. Just to clarify that this is a benefit. So a benefit, you can only access it as an employee by having a house or by renting a house. And with the previous dispensation where employees were allowed to rent a house and were given an allowance for renting a house, but with the current dispensation, the intention is that all employees must own their own properties. They must have a house. So the benefit gets activated. If you are not owning a house, then and you are an employee who's joining the scheme after the dispensation in respect to rentals of the houses, then you will certainly not be able to tap into this benefit. So it's just important to clarify that benefit. For the level 1 to 10, it's open for all the employees, but they have to activate it by that. The issue around awareness is an ongoing issue, and one of the decisions we had made in the incoming financial year is that we must have a dedicated awareness program with our employees and engagements using the available means of engagement, because yes, COVID has happened and COVID is forcing us to do things differently, so we must be able to use these platforms that we have currently access to. The reality of the situation is that some of our employees, especially at these levels, do not even have access to these digital capabilities. They rely on their HR units within their departments to be able to provide information to them and to run. We rely on those HR units to also run sessions with the employees on the government employee scheme, housing scheme. But if the HR department of that particular unit, I mean that particular department, the unit is not effective, we also get affected through those issue. The issue around what are we doing with those who get declined by when they apply. There's an ongoing program in relation to counseling and financial management support and et cetera. But I think beyond that, the activation of a pension-backed capability is also just to ensure that it's a support that is aimed to bring in credibility to those who the banks are declining because of these particular reasons. The discussions that we're having with the Treasury currently is how do we tap into the savings in order to ensure that we create an opportunity through a mechanism for financing that ensures that the employees of government get preference in terms of rates and et cetera. We have not reached any discussions or conclusions, any conclusions at this stage on this matter, but there's some research and some work that needs to be done around it. Because indeed the money is available, and that money is a saving for employees in the public service, from the housing scheme, it's their money. So how do we ensure that we use their money to also enable them to be able collectively to qualify for this housing and to get a fair interest rate in respect to that. The issue around the advisory council, there was a question around the advisory council as well. This is purely just a council that is going to, this is a group of people who will be advising on these matters and just tracking progress. And it's mainly constituted of representatives from the department and representatives from labor. While some are not owning but prefer to rent, well, Chair, I think some are not owning because they don't have, because they don't want to buy, or because they don't have the capability to buy at a particular point. But it's part of the work that we are doing continuously to encourage people to own instead of renting. But also it becomes the people's choices, because we cannot really force them, but we must continuously raise awareness and engage with them so that they are taking the benefits, they are taking benefit of this particular benefit. There was a question about the increased uptake. Yes, as we are reporting, there is an increased uptake, and we are happy with that increased uptake. And we do want to ensure that we continue with encouraging more and more public servants to own properties. Then there was questions about, okay, we've addressed the one of employees not receiving allowance. It's a benefit, therefore they have to own to in order to receive it. And we've spoken about debt counseling and rehab as well. Kelly, there was a question related to spouses and equal benefit. If married, do you get an equal benefit? I would like you to maybe to clarify that question. I didn't hear you answering it. There's a proposal to amend legislation for employees to qualify that everyone gets allowance. We will take the proposal that comes from honorable members, and we will take it forward and we will come back in relation to this issue. I think, Chairperson, on the question by Honorable Gondwe, I just want to go back and reconcile these numbers and come back. I'll prefer to send a response in writing in this, because she asked a very specific question. What's the total number of people who qualify? Out of the total number of the people who qualify, how many are getting how many are tenants, so they're receiving allowances for being tenants, and how many are getting the actual housing subsidy. We've shared the figures here, but I just want to call back and confirm what is the total figure of the employees who qualify, which means those employees between level 1 and level 10. I hear my colleague talking about over 700,000, but I just want to go into the system and confirm the exact numbers of the figure so that we don't give a sense of an assumption in respect to that number. But it is in that region. What are we intending to do about those who are not qualifying? Again, I think we've addressed this question. There's ongoing counseling and engagement with those who do not qualify. But on top of that, there needs to be interventions that look at how they can be guaranteed, because the issue is about what guarantees. They have a pension, so a pension back guarantee may be useful. There is also the savings that are with Treasury. That may be a longer process, because we must get agreement with Treasury on how those savings can be utilized, and there are engagements that are going on there. There's nothing at the moment that has been finalized yet. I think that I have tried to summarize everything, Chairperson, except that one question on the spouses, which I would like Kelly to just clarify quickly. Because yes, thank you.
Running out of
time. Thank you. Okay, sorry, Chair. In terms of delinking, yes, they get equal amounts. Before it would be one amount per household, but now if both employees are government employees, they get equal amounts. That 1,400 is enjoyed by both husband and wife. Thank you.
I see that Honorable Ntuli has raised their hand now at the end of everything. Honorable Ntuli, remember we must lock out here and lock into the city.
My sincere apology, Chairperson. Okay. Chair, just one thing to say, the scheme is good news, but somehow, somewhere, it's not benefiting Uma Kumede no Mam Kize Aba Cleaner Uma Department Emma Respect Bakibele by Wasai Mane or Koma Kibise or PPP Angiaz Mtampe Bengitsi Banga Ipenduli Maj Kebahambe Mtampe Bangaskebas Penduling Elingi Lang Wuti. How can Daboba benefit? Because abafuna kuthenga muze marispeke edolobheni bona bafuna ekwaswa imani, and yet abakwazi ukwakha umzo othi umamkhize wake wasebenza kwa Department of Agriculture for so long eliklini. Enkosi.
Honorable Ntuli, honorable members, now we have come to the real end of the meeting. I apologize for missing the last point that has to be shared with the committee, which is this housing scheme for public servants. Thank you very much for everything. Thank you, honorable members. Thank you, presenters. Thank you, Deputy Minister, for availing yourselves to this committee. We appreciate that, dear. I think we mustn't be angry when you have not worked well, but when you are doing well, we keep quiet. Thank you very much, Honorable Chikunga. The meeting now has come to the real end. Thank you very much. The meeting is adjourned.
Long live the chair. Long live chair. Thank you very much, police and PM. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you
very much, chair.
Thank you.
Thank you.